Coming up on Boston Public Radio, I filled up my tank this morning, $2.95 a gallon, and I smiled. We'll ask if plummeting gas prices have changed anything for you, other than making you happy. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory on the sentencing of convicted probation chief John O'Brien, and whether there's a press honeymoon for a new governor. Then Juliette Kayyem, Homeland Security expert on preparations for violence in Ferguson and preparations for an Olympics. She's now part of it in Boston.
The Boston Pops Keith Lockhart on the lighting of the huge Christmas tree and how they recommended the 27-year-old who sang My Way at Tom Menino's funeral. Then Sue O'Connell joins us to whine about having to spend too much time doing her kids' homework. Why is homework Sue's job? Then we'll ask you, is homework your job too? And shouldn't it be your kids? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello.
Why don't you ask me how I am?
How are you?
I'm fabulous. And you know why I'm fabulous?
Why?
Because on the way into work today, I go to the Hess gas station in Inman Square and pay $2.96 for a gallon of gas, which is essentially what the average price is throughout Massachusetts and New England. You probably know since June when the price of gas peaked, the average price, this is amazing, for unleaded regular has dropped roughly 75 cents a gallon. So we're going to ask you, what effect are these incredibly cheap gas prices having on your life? Are you planning more road trips? Is this changing how much you drive? Or are you spending what you save? I have to say, in my case, the impact is purely psychological, but it is totally huge. Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, don't be ashamed if it's having no impact on you whatsoever. You can do that too. But let me tell you how excited I am about this,
okay,
and I'm not exaggerating.
How excited are you, Jim? How excited?
I'm reading some Globe story this morning, and the reporter says the lowest gas prices are at a Cumberland Farms in Whitman, Massachusetts.
Correct.
$2.69.
Yep.
So I said to our colleagues, how far is Whitman? It's 40 minutes. It's 23 miles. I would drive the 23 miles if I could right now to fill up the tank for $2.69, even though I know I would lose net money on the transaction, because it really, the psychological impact of something that's been so expensive, that's a critical part of your life, a necessity, for so long that is finally affordable, I think is immense, really immense. 877-301-8970. These low gas prices, we hope they last, and actually they're suggesting they may go down another 10 or 15 cents before they bottom out. Are these low gas prices having any impact on you economically, psychologically, in terms of your daily behavior? How about you?
Well, you know what I loved? It feels really good.
It does feel really good.
You know, even though I'm driving around my little hybrid, it is a big hybrid. It's an SUV hybrid.
I have the exact same
and
car.
It costs you about like $55 usually to fill the tank. I mean, it's
not
a lot
more
to fill the tank. And not anymore. You're under $50. That feels really good. But I like the person that said in one of these stories, now I'm going out and buying a cup of coffee instead of brewing my own. You know, it's those little kind of things. You don't want to take the time in the morning to make your own coffee. It's an extra 5 minutes in the morning. You just stop boldly at the coffee shop, Dunkin' Donuts, the Starbucks, the convenience store. You buy a cup of coffee. Or the kid who was 22 years old who says, you know, at this stage of the game, $12 a week may not sound like much, but it does make a difference. If you're very young, you're in your first job, you don't have any money to go out, you can go out. You can get a pizza or something like that. So,
you know,
it matters.
This guy, Jack Newsham, who's a Globe correspondent, I think wrote the piece we're both quoting from. Listen to this one line here. He says that he quotes this economist at Moody's, who estimates the savings from lower gas prices so far have put as much as $60 billion back into consumers' pockets. That isn't that interesting, because who knows what billions are. It's the equivalent of the household tax credits approved as part of the federal stimulus measures during the last recession. I mean, think about that for a second in terms of comparison.
Remember, that was one of Obama's first mistakes. He just put
your brilliant idea.
He put it in everybody's check every week or every 2 weeks, so you didn't really notice it. He should have given us all a big,
check.
Fat, whopping check.
Well, didn't George Bush do that, I think, in his last term in office? Our number is 877-301-8970. Let me tell you what the economic impact just briefly is with me. I don't do a calculation. It's not like I'm saying I'm saving $10 per fill-up. I do a fill-up a week. That's $40. That's $480 a year, so I can spend it. I know that I spend more money than I'm saving because, again, of the psychological impact. You say to yourself, even if it's only subliminal, this is great. I'm saving money in an area that was bankrupting me, not literally, but you know what I mean. And I think I am personally helping to stimulate the economy, and I don't think I'm alone.
You know what else, though? I mean, electricity is going to go up a lot. Like they're talking about 29, 30 bucks a month.
Percent.
So you feel as though, okay, electricity is going up. I mean, if you're really one of those people that sits down every night and calculates your budget, I wish I was one of those people, and figures out exactly how much you can spend, it's an offset, right? If the electricity is going to go through the roof, and it looks like it is going to go through the roof, at least you're, for a while, not paying so much for gasoline.
And by the way, one of the reasons prices are going down is because crude oil prices, the dollars per gallon is going down. Why is that? Because worldwide demand is down, and U.S. production, for which, of course, we should not give any credit to the president, U.S. production is up. So as a result, crude oil costs a lot less, and in great part,
yeah,
that accounts for these plummeting,
you know,
gas prices.
But I was thinking, reading this story, you know, that he doesn't, Obama, that is, have much to do with gas prices. But here they also said that the nation has added 200,000 jobs in each of the last 9 months. Unemployment has declined to 5.8%, the lowest in more than 6 years. Consumer confidence last month jumped to its highest level since before the recession in 2007. But Obama's a bum.
Well, you know, by the way, if I can give credit to my favorite pundit, that would be me. Uh-huh. I've been saying that for – David Letterman said it far funnier. I don't know if Letterman went through that litany last week sometime. You know, he says gas prices, unemployment, all this sort of stuff, stock market record. He says, no wonder Obama's so unpopular. 877-301-8970. But you know what's interesting?
What?
I don't know who said, if someone said this to me on television or was said on radio. Part of the reason for that, even though that isn't our topic – who campaigned on that? Who marketed that? Who, you know, we know in politics,
what,
the one
gas
critical
prices?
Thing, no, all these things. When you have a message, you can't say it once. You have to say it nonstop until people can't. That's why it's the same commercial plays on television 5,000 times. Name the politicians who you saw in election season, Democrats, who stood up and said, I want you to know, in the last couple of years, unemployment is now down below
6%.
Gas prices below $3. Consumer confidence at an all-time, but a relative high.
The person who campaigned on that in 2012, actually, was Mitt Romney, who said if those
6%,
conditions were met,
yeah, that's true.
He considered himself, you know, successful, but the success has not
transferred. Well, it gets back to being a horrible salesperson, as we've talked about, vis-a-vis the Affordable Care Act. 877-301-8970. What impact, if any, you can be honest, what impact, if any, are these lowest in 4 or 5 years, half a decade gas prices having on your life and in my case, and I hope on yours, more importantly, on your psyche?
Let's go to Brenda, who's on her way to work. Good morning, Brenda. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brenda.
Good morning, you two. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I listen to you guys every day on my way to work.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I live in Fall River, and I go to work in Framingham, so I'm on the road for at least a good hour and 10 minutes every day.
Wow.
Going and coming. And I actively search out the cheapest gas stations. Actually, my fiancé does that for me in Fall River. But I've noticed that the prices in Framingham at a couple of little places that I do go to is definitely cheaper, and it is a definite psychological effect because I spend so much on gas. Even, you're right, even the $10 difference that I see, hey, I can go get another coffee or I can get, you know, something at Dunkin' Donuts.
Well, Brenda,
exactly.
Even if you don't get anything, it feels so good. And I'm glad, you know, you made the point. It's one thing to compare what the price was in June, which is 75 cents higher than now. I do what you do.
Oh, yes.
I search around for a place where the gas is 3 cents cheaper than another gas station. So what do you save, 35 cents and a fill up? But it feels terrific.
It's not that much money. But the thing of this, I'm not going to travel like you were saying. You'd travel to Whitman to do it. No,
yeah.
I wouldn't do that. I'm not that crazy.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
I think you take it in stride. You know, okay, if I'm feeling really lazy, I have a Hess right up the street from my house, and I don't feel like going across town, I'll pay the difference.
Hey,
you
Brenda,
know, I,
Brenda.
So I'm not.
Brenda, take my advice. Meet me in Whitman tonight at 8 o'clock. Brenda, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it.
You know, the other day we were talking about Westminster, which is thinking about being the first town in Massachusetts to ban smoking. Might be one
hearing's
of the first
tonight,
towns
I think,
in the whole country. The hearing is tonight. We were debating whether we thought it was good or bad for Westminster to ban smoking. Christopher just emailed me. He said the low gas prices will be good for the smokers of Westminster so they could drive to Fitchburg to buy their cigarettes, and it will cost them less to get there. That's a very good point, Christopher. Thank you very much.
You know, can I say one more thing about the psyche without beating this thing to death? Forget filling up your gas tank. When you're driving down the street, if you have somebody in your car and you see a 2 being the first number, don't you turn to them and say something? You say, how great is that?
I know.
Is that it is such a sea change. Who thought that gas prices were going to come down? Now, the hope was they wouldn't go up even more dramatically than they have. I'm telling you, it has a huge impact on people's behavior and psyche.
You know, it's the woman that just called from Fall River.
Brenda.
I was down at Fall River at a family thing over the weekend, and I forgot my wallet. So I'm driving
That's
back.
Shocking,
I know. I'm driving back to Boston, and I'm running out of gas, and I don't have my wallet. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Who am I going to call in the middle of the night to come rescue me? But I went around collecting quarters in the car, you know, that I have for parking. And I was amazed when I went in to give the person the money that I had like about $4 worth of quarters. And the $4 worth of quarters was enough to get me from $4.95 back to Boston because the gas, even on 24 or was it 93?
Whatever road
was cheaper.
That's amazing.
I know.
So,
amazing.
If we can, just as an aside before we go back to the call. So, on the weekend, you went to Fall River to visit family. You lost your wallet.
I forgot it.
Now, you were a couple of minutes late for work today. I don't mean to tell tales on. If the boss is listening, why was that, Marjorie? I'm sorry. I forgot. Why was that?
I lost my car keys.
Lost your car keys. Okay, 877-301. It's a true story. 89.
Sometimes it's tough to get through the day, Jim.
Let's go to Hannah. I believe you're in South Berwick, Maine. Hey there, Hannah.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I am obsessed with gas prices. I have been for years.
Good for you.
Why?
Obsessed. Well, I drive about 150 miles a day for work, maybe sometimes more, sometimes less.
Ah.
Yeah. So I have a diesel car, which gets really, really good gas mileage, but diesel has also dropped like 60 cents since I got the car. It makes a huge impact because I'm saving like $30 or $40 a week on gas.
It's huge.
Wow.
It's massive.
What is diesel? Hannah, I should know this. I know that all that matters is how far down it's come, but what does diesel cost a gallon? I don't even know. I'm sorry.
Right now, the best I can get is $3.42. And when I got the car in the wintertime, the best I could get was $4.06.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it's huge. And it makes it just so I work 6 days a week and I used to not want to drive anywhere ever if I wasn't just driving to work and back just to save the money. But now on days off, I can drive, you know, to see friends and to go out for a meal. And it just makes my life. It just makes it a lot nicer.
I am thrilled you called. Not beyond the fact that you're somebody who drives a ridiculous amount of day, but I'm so glad that somebody called who actually said you consciously are doing more things on the weekend that involve driving because of the prices.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Spending a lot more at Dunkin' Donuts.
What? So we all. Hey, Hannah, what do you do that causes you to drive 150 miles a day?
I'm a piano teacher, and I teach on the North Shore. I used to live there, and then I got married and moved up to Maine, so it's a journey, but it's a great job.
It's great.
I love it.
Marjorie's mother was a piano teacher.
Yes, she was. Yeah,
Hannah,
good
thank
you, Hannah. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It is great.
But how do you like that part of her story, that she has made a conscious decision to do things? I mean, talk about stimulating the economy, not to say stimulating yourself because you have a good time, doing things on the weekend that she would otherwise not do because she was concerned about the cost of gas.
It's very impressive, Jim.
No, it is. I'm telling you, this
is
much bigger than just an economic
deal.
News story.
It's a big deal. You know what the problem is, though?
Here we go.
They're going to go up again.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be really bummed out.
You know what you can do, by the way? Well, they're apparently going to drop a little bit more. One of the ways you can also save money on gas, which I wasn't going to disclose, but since we're all trying to help each other here today, is you can do what you did today, just lose your keys. And if you lose your keys, by definition, you're probably not driving anywhere. And it doesn't matter how high the gas prices are, you're saving money.
You know, one of the greatest inventions ever is the thing that they have in your car keys now, where if you can't find your car in the parking lot.
Yeah, the alarm thing.
The alarm thing, and you press the alarm and you can find your car. That's what I need, is one of those things you can do for your keys. You can have a little thing in the house.
Most people have that.
They do?
Can I tell you something about that? When we used to do a radio show that started at 6 o'clock in the morning and you'd leave your house at 3:30 in the middle of the night and you did the alarm thing on your street, your neighbors, they love that. By the way, they love that. Like 3:15 or 3:30, click the alarm button and, it's just Jim trying to find his car. Jason, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi there.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
You may be changing my mind a little bit here in my perspective. I got my car now in March, and I put 20,000 miles on it. And none of it is really recreational. I drive a lot because I have to, including visiting relatives in Maine. And we seem to have to go up there an awful lot. But I literally have made a decision a while back to ignore the price of gas, partially because it's so horrifying. But, you know, I swipe the card, I fill the tank, I don't even look what the total was, and I go on my way. And every once in a while, you know, you'll see one that just seems so absurd. I'm like, I'm not going to pay that.
Yeah, but Jason, but it seems to me you would be the person. And by the way, I totally understand the behavior that says when it's really painful, I don't even want to know about it. I'm just going to do what I have to do. But you seem to be the perfect person to luxuriate in the lower prices, no?
Well, you know, it, you guys seem to be taking so much pleasure in even saving the 35 cents or whatever that I feel like I may be missing out. I've always just sort of figured, I remember a number of years back, before there were really apps, but there was a website where, you know, it would show a Google map.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Pinpoint all the low gas prices.
Yeah.
And I remember the people at my work, you know, just raving over this. But they would, it would seem like you're going to drive a half an hour out of your way and then sit idling, you know, burning fuel so in line so you can pay less for what ends up being the same amount of gas. You know, it's
my
just
kind of people.
Ridiculous to me.
Yeah, it is ridiculous, but I'm one of those people. So, Jason, you are going to reconsider. That's big of you. You are going to reconsider.
I am. And I just one cautionary note. Yeah. I would say that, and my wife wants to personally save the planet save the environment. She wants gas prices to be $10 a gallon and doesn't like people driving. So when she hears something like, I'm going to consciously go drive more because the prices are low and people are going to buy bigger cars and drive more, she has a fit. So.
And by the way, Barack Obama, I think, is with you, even though he's not talking about it much these days, is pretty much in the same place as your wife. I'm glad you brought that up. We should have. Jason, thanks so much for the call.
Some of our emailers are, too.
It's all
bad. It's very bad for the economy. It's very bad for the future. Very bad for climate change. Very bad for the environment, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you need more fuel-efficient cars. It's a good step in the right direction, no?
Supposedly, hybrid sales were down. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
I did not know that either. We're going to take a break, but we're going to keep talking about low gas prices because we're into it. Across Massachusetts, the price per gallon is under $3. Is this giving you a certain lilt in your step or not? That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are talking about lower gas prices and what impact that's having on your behavior and your psyche. And while we have been celebrating the fact, Jason added a cautionary tale on behalf of his wife, and I think the President of the United States, that driving more obviously is an environmental concern. But at the same time, the positive is, you know, Marjorie, that space probe that landed on the speeding comet, U.S. could only afford it because of lower gas prices. 877-301-8970. So let's temper this discussion a little bit. He sort of rained on our parade, but understandably.
The emailers are too.
The good news is you can do more things. You have more disposable income. I think you smile more. I know I do. But the flip side is you drive more, which is not so good for the environment, as Jason's wife said, and apparently a lot of emailers are saying. So which side are you on?
Keith points out that GasBuddy.com
is the site
with the latest gas prices all over the state. Thank you very much, Keith, for those who
you don't check that.
No.
Oh yes.
I don't.
Yeah. I mean, By the way, I was being slightly facetious. I would not drive to Whitman every time. I would drive to Whitman occasionally, but I do. I mean, I used to check that all the time, and I would drive an extra mile or two to get a cheaper gas when gas was high priced.
Some promotion we were doing years ago when gas was 99 cents.
It was unbelievable.
And at this gas station, and people were backed up for what, like 3 miles on the
we
exit
did a promotion
of the expressway
onto the exit onto the highway.
Yeah,
gas prices at our former radio station.
Yeah.
We subsidized the price of gas there for the exact same as the coal, the number of the station, and it was about $3 or $2.50 below what the price was, and cars were coming from all over New England.
Oh, no.
The good news is people were listening. The bad news is total gridlock for traffic.
And they were sitting there. They were willing to sit there for 2 hours.
But, you know, it's one of those things. Let me give you one last example. When you see, for example, Dunkin' Donuts across the street has had a special on their new dark roast or something, 99 cents for medium. I mean, I'm Really? I mean, it is a big – and you say at the end of the day, what are you saving, like 25 cents? Yeah, that's what you're saving. But again, the psychology of discounts and savings, particularly on necessities like coffee, like gas, et cetera, I think have a profound impact on people.
Patrick from Plymouth, what do you think about the low gas prices?
Hey, Patrick.
I love it. Today I filled up my car for under $3. First time I felt decent about filling up my car since I started driving in the late 90s.
Oh, that's great, Patrick.
So I, as to what Jim said, I'm actually going to spend more money, I think, because usually I go for Stop and Shop gas, and I don't know if you know how it works.
They have points.
So here's the thing.
Wait, I don't know how it works.
Explain,
tell us.
Explain.
How's it
to
work?
People, Patrick.
Okay, so every a dollar is a point. Every 100 points is 10 cents off gas, up to 30 cents. So I think I'll go spend my whole paycheck, $300, just to save, in order to save an extra 30 cents per gallon.
Make sure you buy things you don't need also, Patrick, okay?
Oh, it's going to be all things I don't need.
But you're not kidding about, you're experiencing the same joy I am, correct?
I felt great. I couldn't believe my tank. I spent $30. It was filled up 3/4. It was an amazing feeling.
Okay.
So,
Patrick, so this is how I understand it works, because I have one of those Stop and Shop cards too, where you fill up and then you put your little pass, your little plastic pass, you wave it by and it deducts the amount. Or does it do it before you put it in? I forget if it's before you put it in or after.
You do it before.
Before you put it in. Okay. And then it deducts the amount. That's really great. That's really exciting.
That is a great feeling, too.
Yeah.
And the other feeling is I just spent $300, and I'm going to end up saving maybe $3.
Yeah, but that is – come on, Patrick. It's apples and oranges. And by the way, I'm sure you brought a lot of apples. Patrick, thank you for an excellent call. By the way, the spirit of that call captures exactly how I feel. Not the Stop and Shop. Well, the Stop and Shop part of it, too. But it is a, and you know what it is? Obviously, it comes, if these were decent, better economic times, obviously they're getting somewhat better. If these were really healthy economic times, a la some of the Clinton years, I don't think this would have had much impact on anybody. But because we're, you know, sort of emerging from under a dark cloud in many ways, the fact that something that you see the price, even if you don't fill up every day, which most people don't do, you see the price every day because it's posted on those big signs. It has an impact on you. It really does.
I think people are much more psychologically ready to buy something, whatever it is, if it's on sale, if it's cheaper,
of course,
if it's reduced.
Are.
You, that's how you justify buying two shirts. We really don't need two shirts, but they're on sale, so what the heck?
Yeah, but gas, it's hard, I think. Gas is the kind of product where I don't think people make the connection to the joy part of it directly, because gas goes in your car, and then maybe you do something with a car that is joyful, but it's not like buying an article of clothing on sale where you feel the immediate, you know, there's a causal connection between the savings and the happiness. But I think it is great. In any case, Eric called in, apparently he had to leave. He said we should think about the stupid things people, it's true, do when gas prices are low, like buy gas guzzlers. And it is true. I believe the history is if gas prices were to stay relatively low, then the sales of smaller cars, hybrids, would probably diminish. Is that why hybrid sales are going down? Because
I don't know. I don't know why.
So that's actually a decent – I mean, there's a countervailing point of view here, but it's hard to step on the joy of people like that Stop and Shop.
Although,
shopper.
The most fun thing about a hybrid, as you know, because you have one too, is when you get to a stoplight and it just makes no sound.
That's amazing.
And people just, or you bring people that don't have a hybrid in the car with you, you drive them around,
they say,
and
turn it on, I know.
And it doesn't make any noise. That's kind of fun.
Well, actually, when I bought it and I turned it on, I said to the salesperson, I said, why is the, I've never been in a hybrid. Why is the car not going
on? It's fun. Anyway, Justin from Newton. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Guys, regular listener, like you show a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This particular one is upsetting me a fair amount. I'm just going to make a comment and take your answer off the air.
Sure.
I think the way this last half hour has gone is sort of indicative of a serious problem, which is that people are much more aware of the pleasure of using something that depletes the environment and that poisons the environment. And it's almost an afterthought. Well, what is the actual price of this of gas?
That is a valid point.
$3, you know, but there's something in the way the program is even unfolded here.
How so?
Is that people, it's an afterthought. What is there any damage? Is there a hidden cost? And the hidden costs are enormous. So while you're celebrating, you know, and everybody is celebrating and wants to now use gas, the hidden cost is tremendous. If global warming is not yet a pretty profound problem and understood to be that, then I don't get it.
Well, Justin, let me respond in two ways. First of all, guilty as charged. That's number one.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of emails, Justin, saying the same thing.
But number two, I think it speaks to, and this is not attempting to escape the guilty plea that I just made on both of our behalfs. Think about it. That speaks to the fact that those who are leaders on climate change. We had Naomi Klein in here, and Naomi Klein a couple of weeks ago said the only way to win this thing is that climate change become an issue not just for environmentalists, but for everybody. They have to see it in every part of their lives. The last 30 minutes, as you aptly described, is evidence of the fact that dollars and cents we all see, including me and Marjorie, immediately and understand it, but climate change requires a leap. Which is, again, this is not in defense of our behavior. It is a statement of fact, since it requires a thought process to get there. Obviously, so a lot more work's got to be done. What?
Maybe what makes sense is when people advertise the mileage on a car when they sell it, miles per gallon, they ought to also advertise how much hydrocarbon for each gallon of gas that's burned in the car will be released into the environment.
Can I tell you something? Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are ready to do that right away. It's a great idea. No, you're right. I know. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Cigarettes carry a warning on them.
Justin,
and gasoline doesn't, and it ought to.
Justin, it's an excellent call.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
No, it's a great call. You make a very valid point.
Well, we should all be turning off.
I'm not driving to Whitman.
We should all be turning off our air conditioners as well.
No, I know.
But we're not.
I have to say, I think the point I made was an important one. It is not integrated. Intellectually, I think most people, not all, get the climate change issue. And when we've gotten calls today and emails, they've made very good points, and you respond to it and you say, yeah, that's a very valid point. But it is not something that is as visceral. You don't have as visceral a reaction as you do to price drops, or at least I don't. And I think that is part of the problem. And I share part of the blame, but I'm saying it's a better sale job has got to be done. We have time for one more quick one.
Brian in West Boylston. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
You know, when gas prices go down, I have more money in my pocket. You know, that's definitely a good thing. But I have kind of mixed feelings when I read news reports about in October, Lincoln Navigator sales up 38%, Ram pickup sales up 33%, while hybrid sales fall off in double digits percent.
Yeah, that's what we were saying. I mean, Eric a couple of minutes ago called or emailed or something and said it is either an incentive or some sort of thing for people to buy gas guzzlers. I think that, sadly, there's some truth to that. Brian, thank you for the call. You know who's the driver of Lincoln Navigator, by the way? One of the great environmentalists of our time. Do you know that?
Who's that?
Leonardo DiCaprio was criticized.
Leonardo
no, he
DiCaprio.
Was for driving.
Yeah, we don't have time to read it, but we have a great email talking about the people that do the delivery services, flower shops, pizza delivery, handyman, construction workers, lawn care people. All those people could use a break. So good for them.
Excellent point.
An excellent point. Okay, up next we're going to be joined by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Joining us on the phone as he does every... Is today Wednesday or Thursday?
Today's Wednesday, too.
Every Wednesday, that would be the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Hey, Brian.
Jim Brady. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
Good morning, Brian. Great to talk to you. So, Brian, I'm wondering, you know, from a journalistic perspective, you know, we just elected a new governor in Massachusetts, and a squeaker, as everybody knows, Charlie Baker is the governor-elect. What's the deal? Does he get some sort of honeymoon, or do we, like, keep trying to track down, or do you, because I'm not doing it anymore, do you keep trying to track down this fisherman that he said he met in New Bedford? What is the perspective journalistically on this?
That mountain of a man, the salty, sweaty fisherman.
Exactly.
We have suspended the search unless he's out at sea and coming back sometime soon. We were just on the docks up in Gloucester, and we did have an eye out for him as we have gotten reaction to the recent decision to halt cod fishing in the Gulf of Maine. But no, look, I don't know whether you'd call it a honeymoon, but let's face it, there is a period of public fascination with any new political figure in a significant role like governor or president. There's a lot of interest. There are a lot of eyes on him. There's a lot of news that is going to be made beginning yesterday when we broke the story here at the Globe that his first cabinet pick was Jay Ash, a Democrat, sending a strong message that he really does plan to reach across the aisle and strike a tone of bipartisanship. So there's a lot of interest here. Call it a honeymoon if you want, but we just, you know, we're trying to journalistically cover the ramp up of his administration.
By the way, do you think the appointment of Jay Ash means that there'll be nobody in the Baker administration under 6'6"? Is that the
how tall Ash
is Ash? Has got to be 6'7". Baker is
6'7", according to the story today.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Wow. You know,
well, I think what he's doing is he's gearing up a pickup basketball team for intramural.
You know, it's funny.
The intramural league up there.
And the contrast. I think the Herald had it on the front page.
What?
The picture of Deval Patrick next to
Deval Patrick's
Charlie.
A small man.
He's about my height, I think.
Hey, but Brian, there's another piece of this that you guys have been covering too. Since last Tuesday, well, actually prior to last Tuesday, my sense is Baker has basically moved from Swampscott to Mattapan. And I make joke of it. I think it's terrific. I mean, for a Republican to go places that Republicans traditionally don't go, and I think it's one of the reasons he ended up winning last Tuesday. We talked about on the air, not only because of how he did in majority minority communities, the Globe reported 10% better than he had 4 years ago, but the impact that had on liberal voters in the suburbs. The sense I get, I know it's 7 days into this, but we watched his campaign, the potential for this guy to realign a very narrowly based Republican Party is there, don't you think?
I think it's absolutely there, and I think the difference between him and, say, Mitt Romney on this front is I think he might have a level of engagement in the inner cities that Romney, for all his good intentions, never really had. I mean, let's face it, Romney was somewhat aloof on a lot of these issues, and Baker looks like he is there to govern in a way that Romney may not have been, because Romney did take his eye off the ball about 2.5 years in to pursue the presidency. And Baker, given his very moderate views, I almost said extremely moderate, but that's a bit of an oxymoron, very moderate views on social issues, may realize that he won't be palatable to the National Party, so he may concentrate on being governor of Massachusetts for a term or possibly two terms.
Well, you know what else was rather un-Republican of him as well was his talking about right after the election about how he's going to focus in on opiate addiction,
yeah.
You know, which is running roughshod all over the Commonwealth, all these poor families losing children and stuff. That's a rare – you don't think of that as Republican either.
Maybe not, but you know the issue, the addiction is just ravaging communities, not just in the city, but you know, all sorts of suburbs, middle class suburbs, affluent suburbs, and then rural areas as well. I mean, we've seen the impact in Vermont and Maine and New Hampshire, out in the western part of the state. It is just an awful situation out there, and I actually, Marjorie, I don't know if that's a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. I just think it's a humane issue, and it's the right thing to do for Charlie Baker to focus on this.
I agree. By the way, has he called you?
Charlie Baker?
Yeah.
Is this like a challenge because you two have been texting every day?
No, we've not. We're not texting at all. I don't text with governors.
That's not true.
Well, a little bit of texting. Has he called you?
Jim worms his way right in there.
Okay, fine.
You know, it's unbelievable.
In other words, he hasn't called you, right?
Well, I wouldn't have expected him to call me. Why would he call me?
Well, you're the editor of the most important newspaper in New England. I would say that is worthy of something. But have you called him?
No, we have not. It didn't cross my mind to call him. We haven't had any communication.
But isn't the, I don't mean this facetiously. It isn't that, I wouldn't say protocol, but shouldn't there be a meeting of the editor of the newspaper of record in New England and the new governor of Massachusetts, or no?
Yeah, I suspect someday. But listen, he was just elected a week a week ago, right?
Yes, he was.
So he is under siege. Everybody and their mother and father is reaching out to him, searching for 30 minutes of his time, hoping to get on his radar. I don't need that. And in due time, I have no doubt we'll grab lunch or something like that. But there's no need for that right now.
When you do talk to him,
he's got plenty of other things to do and plenty more people to worry about.
When you do talk to him, can you ask him why he hasn't returned my texts for the last couple of days, if you have time for that? You know, Brian, before we leave
there's no end to these bromances.
Okay, fine. Before you leave the Charlie Baker topic, I think Frank Phillips has a story. Talk about people.
Oh, I love this.
These circular firing squads.
Gossipy.
They finally, after years, they have a Republican governor. No constitutional officers are Republican except for the governor and lieutenant governor. No members of our 11-member congressional delegation. And these completely clueless Republicans, more to the right by a lot than Charlie Baker, are challenging his choice for the chair of the Republican State Committee. It doesn't get any dumber than that, does it?
No, I mean, in some ways, it almost seems like faculty politics or running for the running for the to head the Elks Lodge out in whatever town you want. I don't know why. First of all, I don't know why Charlie Baker would want to get too involved in this stuff, because no good can come of it.
But he did. No, he did. But once he did, he's the governor, newly elected. He's the one Republican of some stature, along with Karen Pulido. You respect his decision, no?
Yeah. Once you do wade into it, yes, you do respect his decision. But if they're not going to, why get down in the mud with these other people? Why do that?
I agree.
Yeah. Well, I guess because there's no one else in the party. I mean, how many of them?
Yeah, but
are
why
there?
Challenge the guy? You either beat him and you diminish the stature of your new governor in 2 seconds, or you lose to him and you're the outs.
No, but my point, Jim, is once he does get challenged by these people, does Charlie really want to spend even a minute of his day fighting them? That's my point.
I hear you, but I don't think he wants a law. Well, I don't know. In any case, I found it an odd development.
Do you think anybody but you and, we had a story in the paper today, so we care about it.
Yeah, Frank Phillips, me, and the Boston Globe. Yeah. Other than them, nobody.
I mean, really, do you think the audience is for the Republican infighting?
Infighting.
It's not significant.
Infighting, like I said, Brian, it's always fun to read about. I read every word of Frank Phillips' piece.
But let me be clear. It was a very good Frank Phillips.
Okay,
yeah,
fine.
I was reveling in all the, what's the word for the, I always mispronounce it, shang fraud, those cold blood, or whatever it is.
We're not telling
you. What I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to even try. So let's move on to the probation department. As people may know, the sentencing, John O'Brien is due to be sentenced today. He headed
tomorrow.
Up the probation department. Well, it could be today or tomorrow.
Well, maybe you're right. Yeah, the hearing's
Well, I've read
today.
Two
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
One said today and one said tomorrow. So today or tomorrow, we'll put it that way. And as people may know, like I said, he headed up the probation department. He was convicted in July of running this elaborate racket, like a rigged job hiring scheme. And he's facing up to 6 years in prison. He's got two other co-defendants as well. What do you think he should get, Brian?
Boy, that's a loaded question, Marjorie. I would not offer an opinion on something like that. It's it's the state is pushing for they're pushing 6 years, right?
Yes.
It's a tough call, and it's going to be a very interesting 2-day hearing, or at least it's scheduled for 2 days, today and tomorrow. I don't know what he should get. I suspect he will get prison time, but I just don't know. I don't know. You guys obviously have an opinion on this.
I don't know either. I mean, on the one hand, Milton Valencia had a great story today. You know, all these letters that people wrote to the judge as they usually do, telling him how O'Brien was a great guy at home, the bedrock of the family, coached kids in sports and all that kind of stuff. They obviously saw him in a different light. And you also had the factor that they were all these unindicted conspirators or legislators who were very happy to have John O'Brien do their dirty work, getting people that they liked jobs. And you feel kind of icky that they're not, that they kind of got away from this scot-free. And they also have this, I think, kind of a tough judge. Remember when he was convicted last July and his wife fainted or kind of passed out right there in the courtroom? Judge Young just kept saying, keep reading the verdict. You know, I mean, he didn't seem to be overly concerned about poor Mrs. O'Brien. So he may be facing tough time, but you know what I mean? It's complicated because I think he did do a terrible thing, and it didn't just hurt the taxpayers, but it hurt all these other people who should have gotten those jobs. On the other hand, he's
including
taken,
a cousin of yours, by the way,
yeah,
in the
including
spirit
my,
of full
my
disclosure.
Cousin, that's right, who toiled away for years, and it affected her pension and her ability to retire and everything else. But anyway, but
well,
then these
yeah,
other people
I mean,
getting
look,
away with
I,
it.
I agree. This is complicated, but let's be honest. Your life is complicated, and most of life exists in that yawning gray area in between good and bad. And let's keep in mind a couple of things. One, it was It was a Globe that launched this entire thing with a spotlight report a couple of years ago. Two is we proved, and then the federal government came in and proved in a court of law that the probation department was run like a criminal enterprise.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing is what causes so much skepticism and even cynicism about government. It is causing a detachment from government. People can't trust what our public officials are doing anymore, and a message had to be sent. And John O'Brien obviously did committed some crimes here. And maybe there were others on Beacon Hill who did as well, who were not indicted and not convicted. But that doesn't make that doesn't mean anybody should be any more lenient to John O'Brien just because others aren't paying the price as well.
I agree with you. But just you said life is complicated. The trial was complicated. 30 seconds on something that's not complicated, that is indirectly related, is to me the fact that Sal DeMasi is still in prison. I don't know who wrote this op-ed. I can't remember. It may have actually been in the Boston Globe, saying he was sentenced to 8 years in jail. He was not given a death sentence, which is essentially, from what we hear from afar, is what's happening. He's dying of cancer. The fact that this guy is still in jail is surreal to me. I mean, just surreal and away from his family. After Mark Wolf, the judge, recommended to the Bureau of Prisons that he be at wherever it was, Devens or somewhere close to his family, after being carted around in that bus when he was testifying before the Worcester.
After he noticed that there was something wrong with him.
Is it not amazing to you, Brian McGrory, that this guy is still in jail?
I agree, Jim. It's disconcerting. Look, this is another case where the federal government brought charges against, got an indictment against Sal DeMasi after the Globe laid out a criminal case in the pages of our paper. There's no question Sal DeMasi committed crimes, but to your point and to the point of the op-ed, he was given an 8-year sentence, not a life sentence.
Yeah.
The idea that he's in prison, almost certainly getting substandard care for a very grave disease, is really, really hard to take right now.
Or at least, even if they're going to stay in prison, let him be near his family.
But you know what? This is one of our frequent topics, is in my opinion anyway, the overreach of the federal government. They're about to sentence when are they going to sentence that kid that in the Tsarnaev trial that was lying?
Filippos?
About? Yes,
I'm
Filippos.
Not sure what the date is.
I think it's in January. I mean, he's facing a big, heavy time, 14 years or 16
years.
16 years,
yeah.
So I don't know. Should somebody go to jail for 14 years for lying to the FBI, who's a little suspect in their way they do things themselves? I hope not, but that's what he's facing.
Yeah, Brian.
These are good points.
What's that?
These are good points. They're very good points.
Well, you have to resolve a GBH newsroom dispute. I assume you can do that for us because it's about a Globe story.
I am fascinated as to what would be a GBH newsroom dispute.
Oh, fine. Okay.
It was a big one. It was almost knocked out, drag out.
An unnamed anchor, relatively prominent, I should say, at GBH, runs over to me and Marjorie this morning saying, can you ask him, you would be him, by the way, that would be Brian McGrory, can you ask him why it is still front page news that someone is gay? And this is about, where does this kid play basketball?
UMass.
And I have to say, Marjorie is totally on the side of whatever editor decided to put it on the front page. This unnamed colleague of ours is not. Why is it still front page news that somebody's gay, Brian McGrory?
First of all, it's interesting. I thought a GBH newsroom dispute would be, you know, is a California roll, does that count as sushi even though it has no fish? That's what I thought a GBH newsroom dispute would be.
We've had that dispute too, but we figured you couldn't help with that one.
Everybody's sitting around for wine and cheese hour at 4 in the afternoon.
That's right.
Saying, you know, what look, it's a legitimate question, it's one we actually debated here over the past couple of days. Ultimately, we decided because this kid is such a star, because UMass is so good this year, because he has an interesting story to tell, because nobody else in Division I basketball has come out, in NCAA Division I basketball has come out, as openly gay, that we decided that it was an interesting story at this time. But I'll confess, I asked the question, or actually put down the edict. Look, we're not going to do this every time, you know, a field hockey player comes out next or a lacrosse player. Enough is enough. We have accepted as a society that this is how it is, and we don't need to keep doing it. But this particular story because of the uniqueness and because of his story, was interesting enough to give it front page play.
And by the way,
and also it's basketball.
Jim,
it's
you
not...
disagree?
No, I don't disagree at all.
Yes,
I'm
you
actually
do.
No, I don't disagree in the slightest.
I was the one standing up for it, Jim.
No, I didn't say anything. I just sat there in silence, but I agreed with you and Marjorie.
To me, the difference is it's not field hockey and it's not lacrosse. It's basketball. Also, he's black. And I think that there's just not very many black basketball. As you point out, this is sort of a man bites dog story. This is not yet a lacrosse player, maybe rugby player. That's more like basketball. But you know what I mean? Field hockey, I mean, that's not a big deal, is it?
I mean, look, we've had an NBA player, but he was a reserve. We've had an NFL player, but he was not a star, even a starter. This is somebody who is a star in his sport and playing for a team that is really relevant in the country right now.
And by the way, just I don't want to get in the whole argument with you because you're kind enough to come on. We don't start drinking wine in the newsroom until 5 o'clock at earliest. So I mean, it shows you know nothing that you're talking
that
about.
I thought during the holiday season you pushed it up an hour. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Apology accepted.
Let's move on here for a second. George Bush the second, George W. is.
is on a
book tour, 41, A Portrait of My Father. It, of course, is about his father. We're going to play a little sound for you, Brian. This is NPR's David Green asking George W. what he's up to these days. And number 43 describes his previous day.
What did I? Oh, I came in here and signed, you know, about 1,000 book plates. And then I went... had some meetings, and then I went and played 9 holes of golf.
Mm-hmm.
Then I painted for 3.5 hours.
Now, of course, if you don't like George Bush, you know, you contrast that to what's going on over in Iraq right now. You just think, oh, my God, he's painting for 3.5 hours. But you've met the Bushes, I believe. I think you told us that before. And even though a lot of people couldn't stand George Bush's politics, there's something very endearing about him, his father, his mother, the whole Bush clan. I can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know. Maybe it was that they played speed golf up there in Maine on those golf carts, you know, raced around.
I love the fact that he calls it, by the way, in one of the interviews he did yesterday, I think it was on the Today Show, he calls it a love story. I mean, how beautiful is that?
I know.
What's your reaction? And by the way, how did you bumped into one of them on the golf course in Maine, didn't you, or something?
Well, I bumped into, actually, the younger one about 2 summers ago. I was playing at the golf course up there, Cape Arundel, that I think it's George H.W. Bush's great-grandfather might have founded, one of the walkers. And there are 2 greens close together. They're oddly close together. They're like side by side. A green, Jim, is that part of the golf course that you putt on. And I hit a ball. It was on the side of the green, just off the green. George W. Bush was playing the green beside it, and he came over because he had hit his ball right near my ball. And he chipped his ball over onto his green, and I looked down, and it ends up he played my ball, and his ball was still sitting there. And that's a really bad thing in golf, to play the wrong ball. It's a really bad thing. So I'm looking at the ball he left me, and I'm figuring this is going to be some sort of magnificent, you know, presidential golf ball. And it's a scuffed-up Top Flight, and which is a really bad ball. And I realized he just took my title as Pro V1. So I had to call over, and I just said, Mr. President, I think you have my ball. And he came walking back really sheepishly and dropped my ball and took his and then sat there and watched me putt and help me line up my next putt.
Is that true?
Of course,
so well. Totally
that,
true.
That
totally
is
true.
A great, great story. Did you hit sink the putt? See, I know the lingo.
You do know the lingo. Look at you. You're like an athlete.
Thank you.
Of course, I did not sink the putt. I was putting in front of a former president. But no, there is something. You know what it is, Marjorie, to your question? There's something inherently decent about that family.
Yeah, I agree.
You may disagree with their politics. You know, you may disagree with the whole concept of a political dynasty. But there is something very decent, and I don't know if it is their upbringing or what it was or what it is, but there's something likable. Did you see the Bush quote in the story we have in today's Globe?
Which quote?
He said, He's got the younger Bush. He said he was making fun of the fact that he was part of the Distinguished Author Series.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
And he said, I've written a book. It kind of surprised people in parts of our country that I can write, much less read. The idea that he's cracking that kind of joke about himself is really, that kind of self-effacing joke is really appealing.
I agree.
Well, you know, one of the things I thought was fascinating about his dad was that he was into his presidency. I mean, maybe I just wasn't paying close enough attention, but he was quite along in his presidency before I realized that he and Barbara Bush had lost a little girl as a baby, practically a toddler, three-year-old, I think, to leukemia. And you think now that that would be – it would almost be exploited.
Part of the resume
candidate. Yeah, in a presidential campaign. And that wasn't widely known, which I found amazing.
Yeah, I agree. George H.W. Bush came from a different era, and a different era in politics, too, although there are people who accused him of launching the new era of attack ads with the Lee Atwater, Willie Horton ads.
Right.
Well, it was actually started by Al Gore, though, in all fairness. It was in the primary, wasn't it? Wasn't that a Gore ad about Willie Horton the first round? Wasn't it? You're looking at me like
was
I'm
it really? I don't I don't know.
Well, I may be wrong. We'll correct it later in the show if I am. Is that it?
No, he was just saying he was from a different era,
yeah.
Even though he did do the attack ads. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, a much different era where you, just personally and politically, where you don't wear this kind of personal stuff on your sleeve. It doesn't become part of your campaign story. Your appeal to the public isn't so much what your past is or who you are. It's what you believe in, and that's much different than a daughter dying of leukemia at a young age.
Perfectly put. Now, Brian, we'd love to continue this, but there's a wine tasting in the amphitheater, so unfortunately, we got to get out of here quickly. Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Brian McGrory, who is editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. Up next, will the GOP put global warming on the back burner? Will their urgency to do something about it cool off now that we don't have the Republican? We do have, actually, the Republican majorities in the House and Senate. Homeland Security expert joins us for that conversation next on 89.7. Whoops, WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Sorry about that.
Kicking off hour two of today's BPR, Juliette Kayyem, Homeland Security expert on preparations for violence in Ferguson and preparation for an Olympics, she's now part of it, in Boston. Then Suffolk Law's Renee Landers joins us to discuss Supreme Court challenges to two issues many wrongly thought were settled, Obamacare and gay marriage.
The Boston Pops' Keith Lockhart on Holiday Pops, the lighting of the huge Christmas tree, and the 27-year-old the Pops chose to sing My Way at Tom Menino's funeral. Then Sue O'Connell joins us to whine about having to do her kids' homework. Why is homework Sue's job? We'll ask you, has homework become your job instead of your kids? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So the line the last few election cycles is that the GOP has a woman problem. And we want to know, does that problem also include Mother Nature? Well, it turns out it could. After the midterm sweeps of a week ago, Republicans are apparently plotting an all-out assault on Obama's environmental agenda. At the exact same time, I'm sure you saw it this morning, the president is celebrating an emissions deal he made with the leader of China. Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on whether or not this whole climate change issue and the attack on Obama's climate change priorities affect national security is Julia Kayyem. Julia joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. As you know, she's a homeland security expert, faculty member at the Kennedy School, and founder of Kayyem Strategies Group. Julia, it's great to see you.
Hello.
Wait, hold on. Let me get my gum.
Coming from a woman who used to work for the gum chewer in chief himself, that is, for those who don't know the story, do you want to tell why you did that little thing?
President Obama was chewing gum, and apparently that's our takeaway from his trip to China. Not that he managed quite secretly to get the Chinese the number one global emissions polluter to sign an agreement with us, number two global emissions polluter, to reduce emissions over the next 20 or 30 years. I think there's been a tremendous focus on his gum chewing, which apparently has offended the Chinese, all 1 billion plus of them.
Yeah, but can I say, as someone who's been to China a number of times, namely me, because my kids are Chinese, there are a lot of rituals and protocols that when you're, it's not to me, I don't care. But when you're president of the United States, and I know he's a gum chewer, we've seen it before, should know what it is that offends.
I know, but it's like, come on, people. I mean, it's, you know, President Xi and Obama have done something pretty remarkable. We'll see how far they can push it. But the focus on the gum chewing, I understand ritual, I understand diplomacy, but it is silly given the gravity of what they're signing. I mean,
he was allegedly chewing. You know what the White House is saying?
Juicy fruit.
No.
Nicorette,
because he has allegedly has a cigarette thing.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Was
and the elections
excuse.
Were that bad for him that he... No, I'm joking.
It does look a little bad when you're always chewing gum.
Well, you know, the issue was not the gum chewing. When he started spitting tobacco at the steak dinner, didn't you think? You didn't think serious problem?
It was the blowing bubbles. I don't think he should have blown any bubbles.
It was the popping of the bubbles.
Exactly. That was over the top.
You know, we were going to get back to this climate change thing in a couple of minutes, but since you brought up, or I brought up, or somebody, what happened there in China, while you're celebrating this thing, there are those who are writing that it's much ado about not much. That essentially the United States agreed with the Chinese to do exactly what the United States was going to do anyway.
Right.
That the Chinese agreed in much vaguer terms, that there's more symbolism than there is. You're shaking your head. No,
I mean, what's wrong with symbolism? Yeah. I love symbolism, especially when it comes to an issue that is an existential threat for the world, let alone for the U.S. and China. So this was a public statement by number one and number two polluters of the globe.
U.S. and China,
To reduce emissions. Agreements that we already have on our end, although, as you suggested in the lead up, the Republican Senate may have something to say about that. But as specifically or as importantly, China's public statements regarding their contribution to global warming and their hopes for reducing emissions will also change a lot on their end. And that's what's most important, because there's no way you could get third world countries or other countries to sign on to global emissions reductions unless you had China and the U.S. publicly committing to it. You can look at all the loopholes and all the, oh, it's too far away or it's not enough. It is hard to get countries like Sri Lanka and small island countries or whatever other polluters there are to take our commitment and China's commitment seriously without this agreement. And the fact that they did it, I think, is historic. I think it's a huge takeaway from this trip.
Well, I wonder, and Jim has been to China many times, and have you been to China?
Yes, and I'm going Sunday morning. So Shanghai.
You guys know a lot more about this than I do, but you wonder whether, you know, all the stories about the terrible pollution in the big cities there, people wearing masks, people getting asthma and stuff, whether, I know obviously the whole press and government system is very different there, but whether there might be just some increasing pressure on the leadership there. We've changed.
You mean from the ground up?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Look, if you talk to China experts, I'm heading there. If their fear of a popular uprising isn't for press freedoms or academic freedoms. It is because the grassroots green movement, because it's killing their children and it's making water unable to drink and the air unable to breathe. That is their big fear of there being a people's movement. And this sounds horrible given that what's wrong with the people's movement, but in terms of the government keeping in power, they're going to have to begin to address the environmental issues, because that is their big fear in terms of domestic unrest.
I want to ask you in a minute why the Republicans announced goal to gut some of what the president intends to do, and also to move ahead on the Keystone Pipeline, why it's a national security issue. But since you mentioned press freedom, I don't know if either of you saw this. One of the great victories, apparently, that's recognized, I guess, by the experts, not so much by average people, is the president got the president of China to agree to do a press conference to begin with, which they apparently never do with Westerners. Did you see when the New York Times reporter asked the question about press freedom in China? This was one of the great moments.
No, I didn't
see it. I'm going to get this mostly right. He asked the Chinese president, Xi, right?
Yes.
About press freedom. Silence. And they're each at a podium in the front of the room. And as there is silence, and it's pretty clear that Xi has not only no intention not to answer, but he's just going to ignore the question, Obama is standing to the side of his podium, making a face to the audience like, I don't know. He has this great, and it turns out ultimately he did respond to it. And he talked about human rights violations. President Xi, we've made great progress, he says. We know we're not perfect. I mean, not the most perfect answer, but he did respond to the question. But that little interim period when the president had that look on his face like, hey, listen, I can't force him to answer the question.
I'm sure President Obama was thinking, let me see if this works. This might be a good approach my press conferences. And
so why is this
was
a national?
Chewing gum then?
No, he was not.
No, he was not.
Why is this a national? Why is climate change? Why is the issue a national security issue? Which is how a lot of proponents of reform are casting it. Why is it a national security issue?
There are so many facets to it. So one is it is probably the one issue that poses an existential threat to the livelihood of so many people, whether it's in the U.S. or island nations in the South Pacific or China. And so that's just one. But the other is that because of the changes in everywhere from the Arctic to the air, it is causing a fight and competition for resources or clean resources. And that's when wars get started. That's when mass migrations occur. That is when people fight over limited goods. And that is what's happening. So it's both on the sort of crisis side, of which I know very well, but also in terms of this is why people fight. This is why wars get started.
Well,
this is why people
went into Iraq.
This is why people get
time.
Also radicalized. I mean, if you think about famine in Africa or Ebola or whatever else, I mean, when people feel like they cannot give to their children, that there is no future for them, radicalization occurs.
And by the way, we should say, for those who are saying why the Republicans doing what they're purported to be doing, I mean, beyond the business connection, specifically Mitch McConnell, obviously the new leader of the Senate, is from Kentucky, and coal is not an insignificant part of the economy in Kentucky, and he sees these EPA regulations the president is advancing as a direct attack on coal production.
Yeah.
So that's
this is going to be ground zero, I think.
I agree,
we had about a day of kumbaya, but the EPA emissions fight is going to be the first salvo in this is a very different world order. I mean, the irony, right, is that, Mao Zedong would be rolling over in his grave to learn that China was more receptive to popular pressure than perhaps the Republican senators. we need our own cultural revolution here. And this is an area that's going to be fighting. And this is where, I think last time we talked about it, this is where Republican governors who are not necessarily our governor-elect Charlie Baker, but others who are eyeing 2016 at this stage are going to start pushing back on Senate Republicans because stopping global warming has broad appeal. It just doesn't
it does have
play
broad-
out.
out. Field. Although at the same time, you get why if you're down in Kentucky and you're working in a coal mine, you've been there your whole life and your grandparents have, you're looking at the end of your ability to feed your family. So I wonder why there isn't more, you know, let's put the solar plant right next to the coal plant. Why let's put the whatever plant. I mean, why there isn't a concerted effort to sort of sweeten the pot for the people and the politicians there. Maybe there is, and I just don't know
there
about
is.
It.
There is. I mean, there's an effort towards clean coal. There's an effort towards changing these. I mean, we saw this here in Salem, changing coal refineries into green energy refineries. I mean, look at Denmark just announced 2 days ago they're going to be the first country to have public solar panels, and they're actually installing them under their bike path so that the energy that's collected will be from public spaces rather than on someone's home. I mean, the world is moving in a direction that we're just going to be catching up.
And this is happening in these states as well that are so wedded to...
Yeah, I mean, and the alternatives are there. It just takes... I mean, part of it is it takes a tremendous amount of research and development to be able to move from the old way to the new way. It takes workforce development. But we're not... Let's just be realistic here. We are not moving back to a greater reliance on coal.
Right.
So if you actually want to prepare the American public... Senator Mitch McConnell, for the world in which we're competitive in the next 20 or 30 years, it's going to be in different energy sources. And so it's local politics getting in the way of global competition. And that's where the fight's going to be at this stage.
Speaking of politics, in your post-political life, and I know there'll be another political life post your... No, I mean, everybody knows there will be, Julie.
Have you talked to my husband?
No, we know what's
I think you
going
and I
on.
Should have... I think you and him should have a little
you
talk.
Are, I'll be happy to. Just give me a sell. Now, you're involved in some fashion in Boston 2024.
Yes,
What's your
joined the executive committee, the executive committee, and then there's a subcommittee on technology and innovation, which is the area that I love and adore and want to nurture for this state, but also for the bid.
So
I look for
in?
Five or oh yeah,
well,
I mean,
explain
but for five or 6 years, I have been all in. I mean, as a Globe columnist, I was like, you know, I think I wrote 4 or 5 columns on We Need to Do. Yes, I oversaw major sporting events when I was at the Department of Homeland Security. Boston has the potential if we make the short list for the USOC has the potential.
But we're on the short list.
Well, I'm sorry, if we're the final
we're the choice,
one.
Yeah, right,
it should be in the next couple months.
Yeah.
Okay. And I should say, I'm not getting paid, everyone. Just make it clear. Like, no, I'm not. I mean, like, let me make it.
Why
you
are you
know,
doing it?
Because I do believe that it's a way to invest in the future of Boston and the region. It's a way to make us a global city and state. And let me just be honest. I know all these people complain about, the Olympics. It is a blast. It will be a blast.
Here,
so I am, and also it's a way to support technology and innovation for.
But here, I hate to be cynical about this,
I
just know this is going to turn into another massive boondoggle.
You don't
full
know
of
that.
Corruption.
You don't know that.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. This is what happens in Massachusetts. I mean, the numbers that they gave. What were the numbers they gave? Like, it was going to be $9 billion total. Why is it going to be $9 billion total in Boston with the five?
Well, more significant than that, the representations made at that hearing recently was that other than, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion of infrastructure spending, which is already in the proverbial pipeline, all the rest would be private money.
Yeah,
let me just say, hold on.
But the numbers, when you compare it to other places where it was...
Sochi was $51
exactly.
billion.
So right. I don't understand how Boston's going to have this bargain Olympics. And I just... I mean,
well, because
we're going to
take London as the model rather than Sochi or Beijing or any of this.
And how much did it cost in London?
I think the numbers are still out.
14 or 15, I think.
14
or 15.
And so, and it reinvigorated certain areas. I think the challenge for the Boston planning is to ensure that it's Boston regional / Massachusetts. That this is, I mean, you know, this is a regional effort and one that will commit a focus on the changes that we need to occur in everything from infrastructure to...
See, that's the key. Can I interrupt you there?
Wait.
John Fish, who obviously is leading this thing, and Marty Walsh, who is now pretty much on board as well, the mayor, have said almost the exact same things, which I totally support, is that if this effort to get involved is part of a planning process about what Boston and Greater Boston should look like by 2030. That's fine. And I think it was it Marty Walsh who made the point last month he was here when he said even cities which have lost in their bids, like Chicago, where the president himself went to the International Olympic Committee and they came in last, Chicago, have benefited economically from the planning, et cetera. However, here's the big however where I am with Marjorie. As you said a minute ago, Juliet, I want to support this. Yes. I'm not as cynical, even though I ordinarily am, as Marjorie. The fact that we're 2 months away from a selection and the vast majority of the members of the public, otherwise known as taxpayers, have not seen concrete financing plans. Where are these arenas going to go?
Exactly.
Is Bob Kraft going to buy the stadium and move his soccer? We need to know details
before we're picked, it's too late.
John
Fish seems like a wonderful guy. I'm sure he's a wonderful
guy.
But he's a construction guy. So naturally, he's thrilled about this. And the other thing that drives
me crazy, there are a lot of people who are thrilled about it.
This was the move to get Boston a city, just only because, you know, these concerns about whether anyone's profiting was actually a grassroots movement by a number of people who needed an organizational structure, which John Fish, to his credit, took on.
He's a great guy.
Part of it is you just need someone to take charge and to envision it. But
we had the head of the MBTA in here yesterday, yes. Beth Scott, who was talking about the fact that the MBTA is anyone who rides it knows could use a little help, but they don't have any money. And part of the reason they don't have any money is because of what happened with the big dig, which we're still paying for, and we're paying for it forever.
The Olympics planning to fund the improvements that are needed at the T.
Nothing like a date on the calendar.
I do not believe for a single.
Do you think it would happen? But let me ask you the opposite.
What
in a state that just repealed the gas tax? So let's just make it clear here. Do you actually think that the investments that you know we have to make in the city and state to make us competitive in the next 20 or 30 years are going to happen otherwise? I mean, in other words,
here's what the reason why people, I think, rejected the gas tax indexing, because they didn't like the idea of the legislature sleezing out of having to vote for the gas tax.
It's not sleezing
out. It is a gas. It's not.
You guys.
Okay.
You won that one. So we'll.
Okay, can we?
Would you prefer the word slinking instead of sleeping?
No. I wouldn't prefer any of those words. Can we, speaking of a legislature and a change in government here on election day, are you friendly with Charlie Baker?
I know him, and I really like him. I mean, he's very nice.
Yesterday, he picked his first, Jay Ash, the city manager of Chelsea. And a Democrat, which I think is not insignificant. One of the things, and he spent a lot of time in communities of color. I think they're going to be a great diversity. One of the areas, and that's why I'm asking you, where I am convinced the guy is going to go big time is in the area of women appointments for two reasons. One, because that was the area where he had to sort of rehabilitate himself, was the conventional wisdom. And two, did you know he was the chair of the advisory board of the Boston Club or whatever it is, the group that monitors the participation, or I should say lack of participation of women on corporate boards, C-suites, all that
Wait, Jay
sort
or the governor-elect?
No, the governor-elect.
Oh, okay. I never even heard of Baker.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a piece about
him. I read it. I forgot it was you.
In a case, thank you. Juliet is so much more diplomatic than you are, Marjorie.
It was so good.
So do you know, the reason I'm asking this long-winded question is, in the world in which you operate, do you know women who've been approached by Baker to serve in capacities?
No, I haven't.
Is that really true?
But that's not saying much. I mean, first of all, it's been a week.
So he hasn't called you?
No. And it hasn't been a week. Take a deep breath. He has time in the sense that if the picks are as good as choosing Jay, for example, a few days delay here or there is fine. And I mean, if I were to give Charlie Baker any advice, it is because I've done transition for this governor, for Governor Patrick and President Obama, important to put in economic development, to put in housing, public safety teams. You know, those transitions can probably wait because, you know, the transitions are so complicated, but in the sense that you don't need to pick a new head of this or a new head of that. Because
Couple of people you know who might, I don't mean under the radar in terms of do we know who they are, but people who are not be likely picks who you think would be both interested in serving in his administration
I think people are, I would guess another piece of advice I'm giving to listeners is state government is
awesome. If you are thinking about going in, go in. I loved my state government's job. Loved in the sense, like, you can get stuff done. It is manageable. Things move. I know that's sort of against what everyone thinks about state government as compared to federal government. For so young people, young Democrats who are thinking, oh, I lost my chance because Coakley didn't win. Don't think that you can get a lot done in state government on a lot of important issues, and you can get stuff done. It is a reason why most people say all the fun right now in government is in state and local governments. Yeah. It certainly is not
you said
in
it
Congress.
Yesterday, actually, Margaret.
It certainly is not in Congress.
I think that's where all the innovation is going to come from as well.
Exactly.
But Julia Keim, our Homeland Security Advisor here, when you talk about helping the Obama administration set up a transition and set up, I think you said Deval Patrick, what does that mean? Does that mean you open your Rolodex or you open your iPad or call people up? What does that mean?
You find out what areas are still lacking, where the new head should put his or her, his, in this case, priorities. For Governor Patrick, it was from the Romney regime, so maybe a very different approach to public safety, in particular on intelligence and law enforcement, National Guard issues. For Obama, from Bush, that was a big change because this was the first time Democrats had ever walked into the Department of Homeland Security, and a lot of re-emphasis on focusing on preparedness and resiliency more so than on intelligence and some of the more scarier attributes of Homeland Security. And so it's just sort of focusing on that. I will say, I was talking about this weekend because I happened to see Michael Chertoff. And he briefed us, and he was the only cabinet secretary who stayed till January 21st when Obama was oathed in, because the idea was the last thing, if anything happened, especially given
some of the threats against
President Obama, that you would want a steady hand on that team.
You know, this is a quiz for both of you. What relatively high profile unusual suspects served on Deval Patrick's first transition team? Charlie Baker.
Oh, really?
I'm 99% sure.
Someone check that.
I believe, double check that, you guys. I think he was on a healthcare transition thing. We only have a couple of minutes left.
So, but I've met him, but I don't know him very well. But
he used to be a staff person for Richie Volk, who was a very controversial Ways and Means chair during the Dukakis era, who was long gone in the House. And then he ultimately ended up being, I think he's been city manager for more than a decade and gotten pretty high grades for the quality of his work.
He's at Mass Inc.
Chelsea. He's the head. He's the city manager at Chelsea.
Is he pulling a $300,000 in Chelsea?
No, I don't think he is.
No, I don't.
And if he is, he's taking a huge pay cut.
Yes. We know those prices, but
only teasing.
Speaking of
city
preparedness,
in Cambridge.
He's gone and he's wonderful and he did a great job.
You guys doing pretty well, I understand.
Hey, he's wonderful too. Rich Rossi is terrific. Hey, before you, you're a Cambridge kid too.
I
forgot. Before you go away,
my street was clean today.
Speaking of preparedness, Ferguson, I know it's necessary, but when you hear let's hear, this is the governor of Missouri yesterday
speaking
about what essentially they're preparing for the possibility that the grand jury chooses not to indict the police officer, Darren Wilson. Here it is.
We have been working around the clock to prepare to keep the residents and businesses of St. Louis region safe, regardless of the outcome of the parallel local and federal investigations. Officers from the Missouri State Highway Patrol, St. Louis County Police, and St. Louis City Police will operate as a unified command to protect the public.
Missouri. Now, I know that it's necessary if you're a responsible public official in charge to do what he's doing. It's so perverse to me that essentially elected leaders and others have to say, don't worry, we're prepared for rioting and violence if the grand jury does what some people in Ferguson do.
It's a sad testimony, but absolutely necessary given the sort of flat-footed militaristic response by the police in the wake of the shooting. I would suspect they are maybe starting to get hints that the grand jury is going to come back with no indictment. If I were the judge, I would probably hope that announcement would come out on a Monday at 11 a.m. rather than a Friday at 4 p.m. What's today? Wednesday.
When people are at work.
People are at work and you don't look at a weekend. I'm a little bit nervous. They keep saying in a couple hours or a couple days. It's like they can't possibly release this Friday at 4 p.m.
Have the grand jury ever done – I don't know if you've heard – a lot of store owners, I mentioned this tomorrow. Yeah. And by the way, Charlie Baker was on the budget and finance transition team. Thank you to our colleagues for confirming. Just one more minute here. a lot of the store owners who, by the way, have nothing to do with what went on, were begging for 48 hours notice from the U.S. Attorney's Office saying, essentially, we need time. We have to board up our stores, et cetera. They never give any. Does grand jury ever say?
They could. I mean, the presiding officials could definitely delay. And they could give notice.
Well,
Jay Nixon, the governor, who was completely not present during the first rioting, and it was just sort of abysmal. His use of the National Guard, I think, is probably relatively smart given the concerns with the local police there.
Even though the Highway Patrol guy, that Johnson guy, has gotten rave reviews for his work.
Julia, there's not enough of them.
You're a Homeland Security expert. You're also an attorney. I mean, isn't there a way that they could, because the secrecy of the grand jury, I think, has been very difficult for this young man's family, not knowing what has gone on the old line that, you know, a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, and if there's no indictment, they're going to believe with some understandability that the prosecutor didn't try very hard to get an indictment. So what's next? I mean, is there – that's
civil
it?
Civil rights violations from the U.S. Attorney, right?
And that would be –
And that's it.
That's it. That's it. But that's just the nature of the of a system that has worked for good or for bad, because the grand jury could come out with an indictment. But it's better to be prepared, better to have a show of force, not to scare people from asserting their First Amendment rights, but to protect citizens, given what we know happened before. And it's a sad commentary, but we'd be stupid not to have learned from what happened in August.
Julia,
I won't see you for a couple weeks.
What? You're traveling?
Shanghai, Doha, on the road. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
By the way, next week I'm going to be in Somerville, Danvers,
Revere. To Whitman to get the
I'm
cheap
going
gas.
To go, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm going to the Braintree Mall over the weekend.
You guys have fun.
We'll miss you. See you soon.
I'll see you in a few weeks.
Juliet Kime joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. She's a Homeland Security expert, faculty member at the Kennedy School, and founder of Kayyem Strategies Group. Juliet, thank you so much for being here. Up next, it is the legislation that cannot get a break. Obamacare heads back to the Supreme Court. What's at stake this time around? Law professor Renee Landers joins us for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Summer of, I think it was 2012, I'm Jim Brody, she's Marjorie Egan, by the way. Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers was a fixture here at WGBH, providing daily commentary as the Supreme Court weighed the fate of the Affordable Care Act. Now, as Obamacare heads back to the Supreme Court, will the same intensity of drama play out? Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on what awaits President Obama's landmark legislation is, of course, Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers. Renee, it's great to see you.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Thank you for coming in. So what does await the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, before the Supreme Court?
Well, just to frame the issue a little bit, you know, the issue is whether the IRS interpretation of the statute that that the federal government can pay tax subsidies for insurance purchased on federally operated exchanges is correct, is, you know, sort of the narrow legal issue that's presented. But at stake is, you know, about half the states, two dozen of the states, have not made their own health insurance exchanges, and the federal government is operating them. And that would mean if the Supreme Court were to invalidate the IRS's interpretation of the statute, then that would mean all of the people in those states that have purchased money on the insurance on the federal exchanges would lose their subsidies, and that would render, you know, their insurance, you know, essentially unaffordable for them.
I want to talk about what would happen if that were to happen. But before we get there, for people who haven't been following this thing, I think we discussed it in its early stages a month or two ago with you. The wording of the statute says exactly what the critics of the Affordable Care Act say it says. It says the subsidy shall be available, I'm paraphrasing, for those who are get their health insurance through state exchanges. And what essentially what the administration is arguing, correct me if I'm wrong, is the statute doesn't mean what it says. It was clearly a typo. There was no intention, nor was there any sense in the debate in Congress, even from critics, that we should include subsidies for state exchanges, but not include subsidies for those who purchase through federal exchanges, where there's no state exchange. So, but how does a court look at that thing? Does the legislation not speak for itself on its face?
Well, I mean, this is a question of how narrowly you're going to look at the provisions of the statute, right?
So, as opposed to intent?
As opposed to intent and as opposed to the statute as a whole, where there are a host of other provisions that refer to, that obviously allow for the creation of federally operated exchanges. And one has to assume that half a dozen other provisions assumed that they would be treated exactly the same way as the state-operated exchanges would be. It's setting up this debate about different theories of statutory interpretation, which is, nerdy lawyer issues, about whether we're going to, rely on the narrow text of that narrow provision or look at the statute as a whole and come to some reasonable
statute
conclusion.
As a whole, good for Barack Obama and the Affordable Care Act. Narrow interpretation, bad for the Affordable Care Act.
But don't we presume that because the court agreed to take this case anyway, that means that there are some people who want to do something here? I mean, they didn't have to take this case, and they did.
So the cynical view is, right, that's they didn't have to take the case because there's technically right now no split in the circuits, which is the classic reason for taking a case like this. One reason for taking the case that's the non-cynical view is that it's an issue of such major importance for this major federal program that having a definitive Supreme Court interpretation as early as possible to remove any controversy or doubt would be really important. A cynical view is that, we had the election last week's elections, where the Republicans now will have control of both houses of Congress. And if the Supreme Court were to say that the statute can't be interpreted the way the Obama administration wants to interpret it, then it would need a congressional action to change the statute to allow for the continued payment of subsidies on the federal exchanges.
Or governors of unfriendly states would have to say we're now going to set up a state exchange.
That's right.
Which would allow our lower income citizens to get tax subsidies.
Right. Places without them are, of course, as you say, with unfriendly governors in many Republican states.
Unfriendly to the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. And a lot of them are in the South. They're that big block of states in the South.
Can I speak to the cynicism thing? I'm so glad you brought that up. I've read a decent number of books about what happens behind closed doors of the Supreme Court. I love those stories. I mean, they really are. And anybody who thinks, and this is not to show any disrespect for any set of justices, that politics have nothing to do with decisions is a fool. I mean, it does. I'm not saying in every case, but politics does. I totally buy the notion that I don't have any independent evidence, that one of the reasons, was it four justices have to vote to review a case, is because they saw a weakened president, they saw a Republican ascendancy, and I would argue, if I were one of the people who don't like this, there is a mood swing in this country which permits us, I don't mean legally, but whatever, socially, to take this case. Do you think that's preposterous?
No, I don't think
You just think it's cynical.
Yes, but on the other hand, I mean, I guess, it depends. Lawyers debate about this all the time. I mean, the debate's going on in legal proceedings about the Partners Healthcare acquisition of South Shore Hospital with the judge's comments from the bench the other day.
Critical of Martha Coakley saying that her behavior was politically motivated, and Coakley shot back saying the judge said something, "I didn't mean to offend you." And Coakley said, "Well, you did.
Right.
Good for her.
Good for her. I agree."
Yeah. And so, but I actually think it's kind of healthy to do what you did, which is to acknowledge that there is, ideological and political content to this. The law is not this sort of, neutral enterprise. And I think it actually is more cynical to not acknowledge that that's going on, because then it becomes very hard to explain and rationalize what the courts do.
But one of the things, and maybe I'm sounding like Pollyanna in this case, is if they get rid of this whole thing, if the court rules against Obamacare, then you do have all these millions of people who are suddenly going to be losing their insurance, and a lot of them are not people of means. I don't know. You think maybe they wouldn't want to be the judge that took away health care from the really needy, you know what I mean?
Well, that's it. So I think that I think you make some really good points. And actually, a lot of these states where there are these people who have purchased insurance on the exchanges also are some of the states that have some of the poorest health indicators in the country. And so it would be particularly tragic in those circumstances. I mean, you know, I think it is in some situations a life or death proposition if people have insurance or not. But I think this puts Chief Justice Roberts in the hot seat again, like he was in the Affordable Care Act case, because, you know, he can think about aligning himself with the firm textualists, I will call them, on the Supreme Court, like Justice Scalia and Justice Alito. Or he can think about, you know, what is the legacy of the court and how will this be viewed? Does he want to be the person who casts the deciding vote in a case that, you know, basically, you know, at least interrupts, if not takes away, health insurance for millions of people in the
country?
And
but I assume if he were to be the deciding judge in the case, what he would say is part of what we discussed before, that we throw this back to the states,
yeah.
Which is what conservative justices often believe on almost everything, which is the way to fix this is any governor tomorrow should file legislation in one of these states where there's not a state exchange to implement a state exchange, and they will effectuate the same outcome that the Obama administration wanted, except through the back door. So he does have an out, even though obviously that's a little more detailed than most people would see this thing.
One more question for me on this, Renee Landers from Suffolk University. So if the Supreme Court does what's the correct verb? They're not going to wipe it out completely. They're going to damage it.
Say that you can't give tax subsidies.
Yes. But what does that mean for the law in total? I mean, we have a state exchange here in Massachusetts. Lots of other places have state exchanges.
States, right?
Yeah. It really. I think it doesn't really have any impact whatsoever on the overall statute. It just means that the status of the statute, that it'll be just less effective than it was intended to be in terms of opening up more access.
So it's not going to wipe it out?
No.
Okay.
Well, except for people who are lower and moderate income who won't be able to afford the health insurance.
Right.
So the good news is you have it, you can't afford it.
Right.
other than that, it's sort of like everything in life.
Yeah, but not everywhere.
Exactly.
Not everywhere.
You know, I am one of these, talk about cynical, I am the opposite when it comes to this. I'm one of those naive people that says when the Supreme Court decided not to take those gay marriage cases, what they were basically saying is it's over.
Yeah.
This debate is over. While we're not going to formally embrace gay marriage quite yet and make it a constitutional right throughout the country, now it's state by state, we're basically declaring it's over. But apparently it's not over because they finally got an appellate court that refused to strike down a ban on gay marriage. Was it Kansas? I can't remember.
Wherever the state is.
Yeah. What does that mean? Is this just a temporary bump in the road, or is it possible that this issue could reemerge in front of all nine of these people?
I think it's possible it could reemerge in front of all nine of these people, but I think that, you know, as you pointed out, you know, I do think it's sort of over for most of the country. The issue is over, and I think it would be very hard for the Supreme Court to come in and say, oh, by the way, there's no constitutional right, because that would, you know, wipe out some of these court decisions that have made it possible for people to get married in the states, and I think that would create really
so they
massive confusion.
Are the ones or the justices who are? I know you're not in those rooms, but are the justices who are not comfortable with gay marriage as either morally or whatever adverb it is? Are they together enough to acknowledge, by refusing to take these earlier cases, and in essence, a couple of months ago, legalizing gay marriage in another dozen or 18 states? We have essentially made this the law of the land by our inaction, and we would look foolish, essentially invalidating what we allowed to happen.
Yes, I think so. And I think that there's also the view that even if, you know, some of the conservative justices, you know, would want to write their opinion about, you know, why this is wrong morally or otherwise for the country, might bad for families, whatever they want to say about it, you know, Justice Kennedy, I think, would be very hard for him to walk back from these other gay rights decisions that he's authored and say, okay, this is where I draw the line. That really wouldn't make a lot of sense for him. So I think that the assumption is that there are probably at least five votes to affirm the right, a constitutional right to marry for same-sex couples.
You know, one of the things we talk about here all the time is the age of the Supreme Court. Some of them, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is well into her 80s.
81.
And the concern, if you are looking at someone dying or not dying before Barack Obama gets out of office and has a chance to appoint someone else, you might have a Republican president. The makeup of the court will change.
Right.
And it could become more conservative. Is there pressure on this woman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to retire before?
Well, it's too late now. The Republicans have taken over the Senate, right? So the window is closed. No,
that's right. That's a very good point. You're right.
That would automatically, constrain the kind of person that Obama would be able to appoint to replace anyone on the court who was to leave now at this point in the term. So she's
going to hold on until the next.
Right. The argument was until last Tuesday.
You're absolutely right.
The argument was that some people were putting pressure on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal, always liberal leaning justice, retire while Barack Obama's president and the Democrats control the Senate. They're the ones who confirm or reject the nomination. But now, again, with a Republican Senate, that opportunity is gone. So everybody has got to pray for good health for a woman who's had cancer at least twice. Am I right?
Right.
I think a couple of
times.
Yeah,
well, she had some. Yeah, she was very ill, but there was a great piece about her doing push-ups and her physical regime to keep herself in shape.
Has any justice ever stepped down? I know you're not a Supreme Court historian, but is there ever been a justice that comes to mind who has stepped down? I can't think of one. Not that I am an expert on the Supreme Court. And said it was for that reason. It was we know that, for example, Sandra Day O'Connor stepped down to take care of her husband who had Alzheimer's, correct?
Right.
And there have been other examples.
Right. But that was also at a time when, there was a Republican president
exactly.
who could replace her. So, perhaps that factored into her.
But no one's ever said it aloud as far as I'm leaving because I want to ensure that there is the same political composition of the. You know what's amazing? We've had this discussion through the 16 years or whatever we've been on the radio. It is amazing to me, even though I think I understand it. I would argue the single most important thing a president does, other than declare war or not declare war, is pick justices of the Supreme Court. When you pick somebody who's, how old was Roberts? 49 years old, 48? He could serve through 8 presidents.
Right.
And arguably more impact on your life than any piece of legislation. It is never an issue in presidential campaigns. People say it, but it is huge, the appointing power.
It just doesn't seem to have the immediacy of, electing your member of Congress or casting a vote for United States Senator.
Because it's a theoretical thing, I guess it is. But it really is. It's such an immensely important thing, regardless of what your politics are.
Randy Lewis, do you read the Supreme Court books like Jim Browdy does?
I do, yes.
Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? Well, I take a slightly different view because on the one hand, I find them very fascinating and really interesting. On the other hand, there's something really wrong about people talking about all these decisions and interactions that are supposed to
with
be
with a huge smile on her face as she's laughing, by the way.
Private and confidential.
Well, the clerks often spill the beans.
But they're not supposed to.
They're not supposed to, but they do.
But I
forget the one that was the Woodward book. Years ago, but that was a really good one. The Bob Woodward, the Washington Post reporter.
Right.
A really good one about the Supreme Court. And everybody spilled the beans to him. I mean, it was really juicy.
Yeah, yeah. There's The Brethren. There's Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Nine. They're all good reads.
Well, there's also one before. It's the first one I read that talked about the politics. And the case that they focused on most was the Muhammad Ali conscientious objector situation. And they talked about the politics in great part determining what the outcome of that case was. One last thing for you. And this is more politics than it is court. The first black woman ever nominated to be Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch. I think she's the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Brooklyn.
Right.
Marjorie and I said, I think off the air, the Republican majority would not have the you-know-whats to hold up the nomination of a qualified black woman to be U.S. Attorney. And it turns out apparently they are going to hold up this nomination. What's your – and by the way, the Obama administration, from what I've read, has said they're not going to be heavy about this. They're going to allow the process to go through.
Right.
I think that's their position. What's her reputation? I mean, what's the line on this woman?
Well, she's been, a prosecutor for quite some years. Congress has the Senate has confirmed
her in the past. Great point.
Two times. And so, and I guess they would
argue. Were the Republican votes as far as you know?
I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure what the votes are, and I haven't read enough about that particular issue yet. But I think it would be very hard. They would say what's different about this is that this was for, you know, a local position. They'll give the president more leeway like they do when the president is appointing judges on lower courts, federal courts. And now, you know, you're talking about the Attorney General of the United States, and that's a whole different ball of wax. And I think that, that's kind of a very weak argument. I think that, you know, if she's good enough to be a U.S. attorney, she's probably, you know, you'd have to come up with something, you know, that, that would say that she really doesn't have the capacity to kind of step up to this bigger role.
Is there one last thing, which we've probably discussed with you before, and I should know the answer to this. Federal judges age out, do they not?
No, they
can be there forever?
They can, yes.
Oh, so is there ever any talk of Supreme Court justices, there being a mandatory retirement age, or is there not?
I mean, there is. There's discussion. I mean, it would require a constitutional amendment. So because the Constitution says that they can serve, for good behavior while they have good behavior.
Do you want to go to a constitutional amendment to change this?
No, but I don't want to be an ageist. But can I just read you the ages of these people?
Yeah.
And this is not anti-older people. It's anti-unrepresentative bodies of people right. who make decisions. 78, 78, 66, 81, 76, 59, 64, 60. And the kid in the bunch is Elena Kagan from Harvard Law School, who is 54 years old. The average age is, I haven't done the math, mid to high 60s, and they're making decisions that...
Look at Jerry Brown out in California. Turn the whole state around. How old is he?
Yeah, but you know what's the difference?
I think
Jerry Brown was elected
77?
By the people of California
that,
to be governor.
You are being ageist, Jim.
Okay.
I'd watch out if I were
well,
you.
Well, and the other thing is that you don't want... you know, you want people who have had some experience, some life experience making these decisions, not people who just... emerge from school.
Yeah, I accept that. But okay. In the wisdom of the American people, there are some people who are qualified enough, according to them, Bill Clinton, John Kennedy, Barack Obama, to be elected president in their 40s. And I would argue if the American people think they're 40-year-olds, 40-somethings, who are qualified enough to be leaders of the free world, then having a slightly younger crew, not 28 years old out
right.
of law school, but young 40s, on the Supreme Court. Now, the downside is with no retirement age, they can serve through 8-10 presidents.
Right.
But I don't want to amend the Constitution.
Well, and the other thing is, when the Constitution was written, you have to remember that most people did not live so long.
That's
the
a very good point. That's actually a very good point.
Life expectancy is much longer. I mean, although, you know, a person like John Marshall, who was the second Chief Justice, he served on the court for a very long time. So, there were, people who did live into ripe old ages at that point as well, too.
And he did pretty well, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Too
most
old.
Smart.
I'm sorry.
Too old. Okay.
No, not
okay.
him. I'm talking in general. Something should be done, right. but I don't know what it is. Renee, it's great to see you.
Good
Thank
to see you,
you for
too.
Your help, as always.
Thank you so much for coming in. Renee Landers is a professor of law at Suffolk University. Again, thank you, Renee. Up next, the music director and principal conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra, Keith Lockhart, joins us for his monthly appearance. Keep it down. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Never mind that it's 60 degrees outside because our guest has just brought full-on winter to Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the music director and principal conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. That, of course, would be Keith Lockhart. In 3 weeks, the 2014 Holiday Pops begins. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Hello, excellent. Marjorie.
Very good. Thank you for coming in. Well, before we get to...
It's
before
a pleasure.
We get
I'm
to...
not sure I like to be the person who brings winter into the studio.
Well, we're going to delay discussing winter for just a couple of minutes because I am sure, having been in Boston for a long time and during the time that Tom Nina was the mayor of Boston, you get a story or two about the late mayor.
Well, I do, actually, and I was so sad to hear of his passing. Just a week or so before, I had heard shortly before broke in the papers that he'd gone into hospice sort of care, and so I guess it wasn't a big surprise. But and sadly, I was out of the country for the last 2 weeks, so I missed his memorial service, though some of the wonderful musicians from the Boston Pops and the Tanglewood Festival of course performed
did.
For it. But it seems to be something about Australia. I was also in Australia when Ted Kennedy died. And
really?
We also sent representatives to play from the Pops without me. So I guess I got to stop going to Australia. Tom was appointed mayor just before I came to Boston. And so he was really the only mayor I've ever known here. And he was a wonderful friend, great supporter of everything Boston. And Boston, what's more Boston than the Boston Pops? And we had him on stage a lot. You know, we made appearances together. He came and performed. The funny thing about, you know, Tom was not known as a great public speaker.
Right.
That wasn't really his forte. And so we always shied away from having him narrate. When he'd come, he would always guest conduct. You know, we have somebody on stage and they do the Stars and Stripes Forever or Sleigh Ride during the holiday season, because we thought, you know, we're not in the business of making people look bad. We didn't want to make it look like we were setting them up to poke fun at the accent or anything. And so he would always conduct, and he'd breeze in. The first time he did this, he was there like 30 seconds before I went back out on stage. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Mayor, can I tell you something about what you're going to do?" No, it's fine. It was fun.
So, that's you how know, you do it, too, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So there's only one thing you really need to know. Obviously, we give these celebrity guest conductors positions where the orchestra can play without anybody. All you need to do is start them. But some people, that's tough, because some people think the music just starts and you wave your hands at it. So he got up there on stage, made a big announcement. He got up and stood there, put his hands up and stood there rock solid. And the orchestra just sat there and looked at it, because they expected some sort of a twitch that would allow them to start. And he thought he was being punked by the orchestra after a while. And people started to laugh and all that. Then he started threatening to raise people property tax rates. Finally, I just kind of grabbed his arm and went like this, and they started, and he got the idea.
So wait a second. Would there have been had you not intervened with the standoff? If existed forever?
Well, no. Eventually, somebody in the orchestra would have raised
something,
a violin bow and gotten something going. But it was very funny. And you know, he never made that mistake again, because he was a very smart man and showed up a lot of times and was quite sheepish about that particular one. But the last time that we had Tom on stage in Symphony Hall was during the run of the Holiday Pops last year, and he was the outgoing mayor at that point. And, you know, everybody knew he'd had health issues. And you know, I wondered very much if that was the last time we were going to see him. And for that time, we actually said, look, this is ridiculous. We should have him narrate "Twas the Night Before Christmas," because you know it's about heart. It's not about oratorical skills. And I have to say, he knocked it out of the park, and the audience was I think half in tears and half just exultant. And it was really a great one of the best narrations we've had for all sorts of reasons in my time in Boston.
That is a great and beautiful story.
The Globe had a piece about the Pops having something to do with this singer John Stevens that sang
My Way at the funeral.
I guess he'd done some work with you or something like that, and he gave a beautiful rendition of My Way as the after the mass, actually after the bagpipes and everything, when the they hit a little piano in the corner as the casket and the family and everybody
outside.
Else came out of the church.
And
Renice
King sang on as well, who frequently performs with us.
She can
was
really
wonderful.
Sing.
Yeah, the music was much better than you normally hear, I must say, at a regular old funeral. It was spectacular.
Well, this was more than a regular old funeral.
It was more than
I
a regular old funeral. That's right. It absolutely was. It was absolutely beautiful.
Keith, you know, we're talking to Keith Lockhart, obviously, from the Boston Pops. Talk about current events. I was doing some date comparisons this morning. Obviously, we're talking about having an Olympics here in 2024.
We
just
are
talked
indeed
to Juliette Kayyem, who's actually now involved in this thing. Winter Olympics were in Utah in 2002. You were the music director of the Utah Symphony at that same time period.
I was.
So do you have any connection to this? And how do you feel about the Olympics coming here?
Well, I have a lot of connections with this. I have some connections with the current situation, actually, because my wife, Emily, is the VP and general counsel of Boston 2024.
She is?
So I have to, for full disclosure, I have to say that at the beginning.
Well, this was not a setup, by the way. Neither of us knew that she was involved.
Well, I don't know. You may have known this before, but she was working for Eileen Donahue. The senator
State senator from Lowell,
from Lowell, And she was her general counsel and policy director. So, and she was loving the job, or writing, you know, writing legislation, getting it pushed through. And that's really, she likes, loves the behind the scenes things that really affect people and do things, you know. And Eileen was the chair of the commission to discuss the feasibility of the Olympics. And from that, she Emily was asked to go join the startup that was working on this. So I haven't seen much of her in the last few months.
What's good for the goose is they say. What was it like in Utah? I mean, and how does that, I mean, putting aside your wife thing, which is pretty difficult to do, how does what happened in Utah color your perspective on it coming here in 10 years?
I have to say, when I came to Utah, we obviously already knew, I started there in 98. They already knew they were going to have it, and they were in full swing of infrastructure improvements and that sort of thing. Of course, much smaller city in many ways than here, but the largest city to ever host the Winter Olympics, because when you think about it, it's usually in some chalet village.
That's
true. Never occurred
That's
to me
true.
To just say it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I thought it was an overwhelmingly positive experience for that community. It allowed a lot of things to happen that had been on the planning boards for years in terms of mass transit, in terms of interstate expansion. I mean, it created a couple of construction headaches for the couple of years before it. But there was basically no mass transit, as there isn't in so many Western cities, when I came there. And now there is a light rail system that serves hundreds of thousands of people and really usefully really crisscrosses that huge and spread out
city. You know, one of the big things that people worry about, myself included, is the white elephant factor. When the Olympics are done, you're stuck with all this stuff, and it'd be great to have, obviously, transportation updates, but that you have these big empty stadiums sitting there.
Well, these days they are very aware of that. I think on the USOC level and on the IOC level, they very much don't want to. I always think of the rusting hulk of the World's Fair in New York that I went to as a kid, and
so
then you
I.
just keep going by as you go from Kennedy Airport. And there, I think all of the planning is really intended to make all these things useful things that will benefit the community in the long term. I think they from what I understand that they almost require that you show that you are not just building something that's going to become this you know, this rusted out hulk in another 25 years. Being there for the event itself too was amazing. We played the opening ceremonies.
I
was standing on the field in the opening ceremonies with fireworks going off, and I was standing arm in arm with John Williams, Sting, Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was John's birthday. It actually, they took place, and this was also the week after we played the Super Bowl, so it was a pretty good week to be me. John leaned over, and I leaned over to John, and I said, "By the way, John, it was his 70th birthday." I said, "Happy birthday." And he said, "Thanks, man, and thanks for having this great party."
You know, speaking of birthdays, one of our crack staff, and this was, it sounds like a setup, we didn't know you were going to say it. Your birthday just happened, correct?
Just happened. I was in Australia for my 55th, now I can be told.
And I would like to say, I hope you agree with this. Every year, come June, we make a recommendation to you. I'm sure you're waiting for it, about who should be your lead performer. Do you know what great
song? And we always follow it.
Oh, you do? I would say one of the great performers and songwriters of our time was born on the same day as you. Do you know who that is? She's born in Canada. Same day as you. Do you know who it is?
I read the story. Joni Mitchell.
Joni Mitchell.
Of course I knew that.
So,
yes.
So when
you know, when you're a kid and you look in the paper and it says born on this day.
Exactly.
And Billy Graham.
Yeah, well, I don't want Billy Graham singing at the July 4th
especially
thing.
At this point.
But if you,
I think it's 96, I think.
One last thing before we get to Holiday Pops, and I assume you're going to take Joni Mitchell to heart. She doesn't perform anymore. For you, she'd perform.
That would be great. I mean, obviously, she was a transformative songwriter. And maybe we can get her out of retirement.
Before we get to Holiday Pops, what is this deal with the Faneuil Hall tree? What is the big event that you do, and tell us about it?
The Blink event. Blink twice and you'll miss it. No, that must stand for something. But basically, it is a huge tree lighting coupled with that incredibly complex lighting choreography that they've done around Faneuil Hall for these last couple of years. It is a kind of a citywide promotion that launches the holiday season. And for the last couple of years, last 4 or 5 years, I suppose, we've been linked in with them. It's a good way to, you know, announce that we're starting off, and a good way to be for us to be part of the community celebration. Last year, it was just huge.
They said this year it's a 90-foot-tall Norwegian spruce from brought in from St. James on New York's Long Island on a flatbed truck.
Wow.
That's a big tree.
So that which one is the official? Is that the official Boston Christmas tree, or is the one
prune?
That is in the or is the one that's a, or the one that's in Boston Common that's a gift of Halifax, right?
I don't know.
Way back to
I don't
the
know.
The fire relief.
I didn't know there was a. I didn't even know about this huge tree lighting ceremony in Faneuil Hall, but apparently it's happening on November 22nd.
By the way, it's a beautiful tree. You ever been down there at Christmas time
to Faneuil Hall?
Yeah,
I'm sure I have. I mean, I don't remember the 90s.
Well, you
spruce.
Couldn't miss it. It is huge and totally beautiful. Speaking of the holidays, we have more we're going to talk about that is not Pops connected in a second. But since we started into the holiday season, what's coming up?
What's coming up is a whole lot of holiday Pops. Mm-hmm. It's great. I have about close to 3 weeks off now. And then it all starts and the floodgates just open. We open at Symphony Hall on December 3rd. And between December 3rd and December 24th, we play 38 concerts in Symphony Hall. But who's counting? And on top of that, we're also playing concerts in stores in Worcester, Lowell, and Manchester.
Wow. So you have to get your Christmas shopping done early.
Well, I usually get it done between shows. I like I run to Copley, which you can get to easily from Symphony Hall. And the other thing we're doing is screening Home Alone, which has kind of become, in a strange sort of way, a holiday classic in itself, accompanied live by full orchestras, John Williams' score. And we're doing that on the 26th and 27th. So we'll get the 25th off, and then we have to go back to work for a couple days.
Isn't that unusual for you to do the 26th and the 27th? I usually think of you, it's up to the 24th or you're out of luck. Am I wrong?
Well, up until maybe 12 years not even 12 years, 8 years ago or so, we used to perform all the way up through New Year's. We used to
wow.
do several concerts in the week after Christmas, too. It kind of depends also on where Christmas lands on the calendar
yeah.
as to whether people are still celebrating at that point. But, you know, I always felt it always feels a little false to be doing concerts celebrating this day after the fact.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of happy to knock off on the 24th. And doing Home Alone gives us the chance to do something that is holiday-related but not so specifically holiday as our concerts.
You know, the other day when I read the story
movie.
About – yeah, I do too. I'm embarrassed to admit how much I like it, there's actually.
There's a Macaulay Culkin moment from just recently, isn't there? Wasn't there?
Well, there's always a moment on page six usually in the New York Post.
This
what
business of the wire services went out saying that he'd been found – deceased.
Oh, I missed that.
And, well, it was, you know, obviously you read the important parts of the important news. This was on the back page somewhere. And then that he had published a kind of a Weekend at Bernie's picture of him being dragged through a subway, apparently as a corpse. That was a big joke, but got some quite a bit of social media reaction.
And the headline for that story was Home Alone, by the way. So thank you very much.
Good.
You know, I told you
home
the other
last,
day.
Home at last, I think.
No, that would have been better, but thank you. You know, did you read the story about this Stradivarius that was stolen?
No.
$5 million, 300 years old. I know much more about this than I ever knew before I read this piece. Mm-hmm. I thought of you when I read this.
300-year-old box of wood.
Yeah. Well, a box of wood. Worth $5 million. It was stolen. The guy waited for a member of the Milwaukee Orchestra, uses a stun gun to incapacitate him, takes his Stradivarius, again worth $5 million, which made me think of you.
This is distressing because I might actually know the person involved.
Well, I'll tell you who the person is in a second.
Not the perpetrator.
Well, I would hope not. I'll tell you in a second. But are there instruments that are part of your operation that are of huge value that you have to take special precautions around?
Well, there are these days because of the it's funny, it's not funny, but what's happened to high-end instruments, the Strads, the Del Jesus, the instruments that are all from that golden period, which is roughly 300 years ago. It's the end of the 1600s, the first 20 years of the 1700s, have become so much collectibles that they have driven the prices up that very few working musicians can actually ever afford to buy one of these instruments. When I came into this business 25 years ago or so, there were people in the sections of good orchestras, but not Philadelphia, New York, Boston, that had Strads. And
wow.
they had bought them and they cost about as much as their house did. But they, you know, they've just watched them gain like 25-fold in value, and they realized their retirement was on that. But yes, there are valuable instruments in the orchestra. It's rare to have a $5 million Strad in your orchestra. Often soloists play those, and a lot of them are owned by, wealthy philanthropists.
Well, this was on loan. Actually, the guy's name is Frank Allman.
Frank Allman, the
concertmaster,
yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there you go.
I've actually worked with him as my soloist before. So.
Have you ever touched one of these instruments, by the way? There's
yes.
600. You have?
Yes.
What does that feel like?
It is. It feels like you want to really be sure of your grip.
Yeah.
Oops.
So what's the state of the art?
I mean, Perlman, I've carried Perlman's Strad out onto
really?
Stage with him because, of course, he, with the polio issues, he can't carry it and walk at the same time. He's on crutches. So, you know, you're standing behind him like you're carrying the crown jewels.
That's great.
Please, God, this is not the time to trip.
There's 600 instruments, according to this article, that he is responsible for in the early 1700s that are still in existence.
It's, and that in itself is amazing.
Yeah.
And you consider most of those were in Europe and what's happened in Europe since the late 1600s.
So what is the state-of-the-art violin now, if you're going to go out and buy a violin?
Well, do you mean an ancient violin or a modern violin?
If you are a your first violinist at the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the concertmaster, what would be their favorite kind of violin?
What you do, the Stradivarius is kind of the gold standard,
yeah.
But there are greater and lesser Strads, as there would be with anything else. These are living, breathing, organic things, and that's what makes each one is one of a kind, and that affects their value. So does how knocked up they've how beat. They've managed to be over the last 300 years, too. Some of them are in better shape. Some have been repaired more than others. Then there's also the Del Gesu, which was made by a man named Guarnerius, right around the same time. And there are some of them that are of equal value to the Strad. But then there's an entire spectrum of instruments that go all the way up to the early 20th century that are considered collectible violins. And there are great violins being made and violas and cellos and basses as well these days. But the funny thing is we can totally analyze exactly the dimensions. We can make everything exactly the same. You know, they've chemically analyzed the varnish. They've, the spectrum and all those sorts of things. And we still, nobody builds a Strad. And one of the answers to that is, well, maybe wait around for 200 years and it will be a Strad or of that quality.
Because of the changes in the wood?
Well, there's a couple of thoughts. One of them is that the European old growth forests that were used to build these, we don't have wood like that anymore with the same long structural grain because of air pollution and things that have, this was pretty much pre-industrialized Europe, of course, that this wood came from. And of course, those were all cleared as they started to build factories and needed fuel.
But how great were these considered at the time or a century later? Were they considered as sacred as they are now?
Well, I think as we get more stand in wonder of the fact that they are now, they're practically of Shakespearean time and still functioning and still producing great music. But they have always been valued as they were the great instruments of their day when they were made and have continued to be more valued and more in awe of them as the years pass.
Okay, we're talking with Keith Lockhart from the Boston Pops. Can I ask you another instrument question? My piano tuner tells me.
This is when she gets most excited when you're here, Keith. Go ahead.
He's not selling any more pianos, and he would, had the old ones. He would reconstruct the Steinways, the Chickerings, the Baldwins, and that everybody's getting these electric pianos now, these Yamaha stand-up things, which he says sound pretty good. You still have that big, huge, grand Steinway.
I do. It proudly takes up a big hunk of my living room.
Yeah, and pianists who perform with you have a big, huge Steinway.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? Is he wrong about this? It seems depressing that you're going to have this electric piano.
It's, at least to my experience, it's never the same. And a lot of what's never the same is the physical touch of the instrument. More than the sound. These days, when they make a electronic piano, they sample the sound of a real piano. And the sampling is done so complexly, as opposed to a few years ago when they would make one sample of a sound that sounded like. Now they sample every single note on the piano and build a sound that's just like it. So they sound very, very good. But a mechanical keyboard without the actual feel of the weight of the action and the hammer pushing into the keys never feels the same to a pianist. Now, I'm sure they make much better ones than they did the last time I tried. I tried one, and I'd love to be tested on that. The problem is, of course, that how good is good enough? Most people don't really want a 9-foot Steinway.
So is Steinway still state-of-the-art on pianos, or is Yamaha with the real pianos, not the electric pianos, catching up, or is it still Steinway?
Is this going to get me in trouble with a sponsor anywhere?
I don't think so.
Full disclosure, the Steinway is the official piano of the Boston Symphony and the Boston Pops. Steinway is probably still the world standard.
Okay.
Yamaha started building great pianos maybe 30, 40 years ago, and they're certainly competitive. But pretty much, if you look at the great orchestras of the world, I'd say 85% of them, their major house concert instrument is the Steinway.
That makes me happy.
How do people find out about the Holiday Pops, Keith Lockhart?
Easiest way is to go to bostonpops.org, bostonpops.org, and you will see the concert schedule and ticket availability. They do go fast. Some of the weekend shows closer to Christmas are probably already sold out, but there are still good seats available, and check it out.
And by the way, what you should do is you should go home. You should tell your wife that there's a woman, Marjorie Egan, who wants to debate her on the pros and cons of Boston 2024, and she is invited anytime she is available.
I'm worried. I'm worried about this turning into a boondoggle. And I
would referee that match. I'm ready for that.
You know, I think that that's the thought on a lot of people's minds, and I think it needs, like anything else, it's a big step. It needs to be analyzed carefully, and the right people need to be involved in making it go forward, if it indeed goes forward.
Tell your wife, Marjorie, I would like to light the torch if this works out.
Okay.
Can you pass that along?
I mean,
you could come along,
right,
too, if you're free.
You're the first people who have asked to do that.
Okay, fine.
We can jog from here to, you know, about 20 feet
one
down the hall.
One of us can, anyway.
And that's it.
Keith, it's great
Thank
to see
you. Thank you very much
for
being here.
Keith
Lockhart is the music director and principal conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. To learn more about the great and wonderful 2014 Holiday Pops season, you go to BSO.org. Coming up, how much progress has the military made with gay rights? Was yesterday's Veterans Day parade an indication? Sue O'Connell joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3, as she is on Wednesday afternoon, is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the co-publisher of the South End News. That, of course, would be Sue O'Connell. Hi, Sue.
Hello, hello.
Hello. So, Sue O'Connell.
Yes.
We got a lot to talk about today, but let's talk about something we discussed with Brian McGrory a little while ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There was on the front page of the Globe today a story about this kid, big basketball star at UMass, black kid, who's come out.
Right.
And we had a big discussion. One of our colleagues would thought, you know, when are we going to how come these gay guys going to be on the front page all the time? How are we getting over this? Haven't we got enough gay?
Somebody you know quite well,
yeah,
by the way, I should say.
Let me guess.
No, you don't have to.
And I thought, and Jim was sort of with her, and I thought, well, he's a basketball player and he's black. So I thought it was worth the front page. McGrory, interestingly, said they had a debate back and forth in the newsroom whether
that
it was,
he was part of, by
front
the way,
page play or not. Now, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because when I saw that story, you know, I immediately thought, oh, we didn't do a follow-up on him. Like, you know, what we did a big story when he came out, and of course, I can't remember his name, and then, and, you know, how's it been is really the story. You know, now that you have indeed come out and you're openly gay, how is it going in the sports world? And my answer to the page one issue is when folks who are driving a truck for a living or are teaching school for a living and aren't spending their time thinking about LGBT civil rights, when it's a non-issue for them, then it won't be a front-page story anymore.
Yeah.
Brian said that. I'm going to paraphrase, and I don't want to make a mistake. Please correct me if I'm wrong. We're not going to do a front-page story when the first lacrosse player comes out, the first field hockey player comes out. I think his view, again, I surely don't want to speak for the editor of the Globe, was it's a major sport. Mm-hmm. He's a really good player as opposed to some of the pro athletes who have come out who are good players but not great players. And so he said that there's
a
point at which
American community, it's harder to be gay.
I mean, for example, we're hearing stories about now we have 100 women elected to Congress.
Right.
That's a news story. Why is it still a news story that women are getting elected to Congress? Because there's only 100 of them.
Exactly.
So it's the same deal. It's like until there's actually a fair amount of people who are openly gay in the area of sports, then we won't talk about
so
it.
So do you know when the first field hockey player is coming out? Do you have a date for that or no?
I have a date with the first field hockey player coming out. In,
good for
in
you.
Fact, yes.
Good for you. We're glad to hear that.
It's not quite
luckily,
what I meant, but
college,
thank you very much.
So. Okay. There was another very fascinating piece by this guy, Bren Brancart, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who was, a former Jesuit priest. Mm. Now he's studying to be an Episcopal priest because he was upset with the Catholic Church treatment of gay and lesbians. And he wrote this piece arguing that the media has been much too nice about Pope Francis with the LGBT community, saying that, you know, criticizing them all over the place. He was reminded that Roman Catholic institutions had not rehired the people that they fired. They didn't discuss employment or non-discrimination laws. This is at the synod that he was criticizing. He said they didn't invite same-sex couples to talk about dating or love or their marriages and blah, blah, blah. That they didn't condemn punitive laws penalizing the LGBTQ communities for not accepting the LGBT communities in Russia, Egypt, Uganda, Jamaica, on and on and on. Basic point, the media gave Pope Francis mm-hmm. a pass. What do you think?
You know when you go to a community meeting for any reason in your neighborhood and somebody, you know, the first person in your neighborhood raises their hand and you go, here goes Jim. You know, oh boy, how are we going to park? Where are we going to go? You know, this is a very thoughtful piece. I don't mean to totally disregard it, but this isn't what the media does. The media does not every time we decide that, you know, one pope is going to become a saint. We don't all start going, wait a minute, you can't really become a saint. How does he become a saint? What's the miracle? Let's test it in a lab and see if it really worked. We go, great, the Pope is going to be a saint. And we send everybody to the Vatican and we cover it and we pat ourselves on the back that we're including religion in our coverage. So, yeah there's a lot wrong with the Catholic Church's relationship with the LGBT community, with the women's community, with a whole number of communities. But I don't think that it takes away from the positive momentum that is happening under Pope Francis. It's good that someone like this writes these articles to remind us. But at the same time, I think it's our job to sort of do the top level here of what's happening.
By the way, don't you think that the media does give him a pass, which they do on certain things, because the vast majority of the media, which is liberal-leaning, I think people could say, are that way because they are convinced that ultimately he's going to lead the change.
Absolutely.
Is that not it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like if it turns out they thought he was a hardcore mm-hmm. person on this issue,
or
who was completely
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
I think they would, but I think the notion is give him a little bit of time. He's moved on X, Y, and Z. He's going to move on this too at the appropriate time. Give him the room to move.
Well, I also think because we've spent our time nonstop and mostly what you wrote about the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. if you were a reporter for the last
2,000 years.
Yeah. yeah. Well, actually, well, maybe
2014.
Maybe they were writing about it back in the 1200s because I'm sure it was going on. But in the last decade has been about sexual abuse.
Yeah, right.
So this is, you know, and for those people, every time you mention the church, that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. This is another story that's not about that.
And again, just the fact that the Pope raises these issues is news.
Yeah.
You know, and that's good news. And I think it's worthy of that. And it's also important for folks like this to dig in and show us the other side of it.
Who am I to judge?
In any case, who am I to judge? I'm the Pope, but that's who I am.
There's one thing you can judge. This after despite the fact that this debate, mm-hmm. I don't know what other word to use for the St. Patrick's Day parade, is going to go on or has gone on for what appears to be 2014
you know,
years.
The day that the LGBT groups can match in St. Patrick's Day, we're just going to fold big windows up and go.
Exactly.
Our work
mission
will
accomplished.
Be done. Mission accomplished.
But this Veterans Day decision was a very big deal. Was not for the people who missed it, tell people what happened.
Well, there's
and why.
A group called OutVets, an actual group of veterans, openly gay veterans who've served in the military. And they're a national group, and there's also a local Boston chapter that came together this past year. And they marched as a gay group in the traditional Veterans Day parade down Tremont Street and Boylston Street yesterday in Boston. And what's beautiful about the fact that they marched, and they're the first openly gay group to march in the group, is that it's not like they've been denying gay groups to march in the past, and there's really been no decision. They just applied and were accepted to march like other veterans and other groups were. I'm told the reaction along the crowd from the crowd was positive. People were shaking their hands. They're just some guys and gals, you know, many in their middle age, wearing khakis and a blue coat and carrying a banner, and that's it. You know, that's all that happened. So now,
and was there? I wasn't aware. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I haven't read as much about it as I should have. I just sort of read the headlines and heard the superficial part of the story. It was literally they decided to apply. They applied and they were granted because they're veterans.
And they're veterans, and they meet the criteria. And they've met with Mayor Walsh already. The group has, and Mayor Walsh is excited that we've part of the rejection on the level of the St. Patrick's Day parade organizers of rejecting gay groups was that number one they say that there was no truly organized group of veterans, that they were just organized to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade. They didn't exist for any mm-hmm. other reason, which is a valid complaint.
Is a valid complaint?
Yeah, it is a valid complaint. Okay. I mean, I think that's true for some of the groups that have applied, not the 1990 ones, but the recent ones. So now we have a group that actually exists, has is a chapter of a national organization. And now when folks like Dear Wacko Hurley says it's not a St. Patrick's Day parade, it's an evacuation Bunker Hill Day parade, and it's for the veterans, and he's going to really have a hard time rejecting this group.
I assume Walsh, who was a terrific advocate mm-hmm. for inclusion last time, is right. fully aware of the argument you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Better than anybody.
Yeah, you know, so now we have a group. I don't think they had LGBT in their sign, but they were clearly, they had the lovely rainbows.
So
and
they were identifiable.
Out,
okay.
They were clearly LGBT.
You know, do you know any guys that are gay vets?
Yeah.
Because I've often thought, wow, that would be hard. I would think if I'm projecting here, but if I were a gay guy, it would be hard to join
less,
the Marines or something.
You know, it's funny. It's less hard than you think it is because from the folks that I know personally, I know there have been horror stories, but I think there are for everyone because you're fitting into a group and you're just kind of shaving off the areas of yourself that aren't like the others and you become a team, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're with a good level of fellow service members, it's not your religion, your background, none of that becomes an issue because you become a cohesive team. And I don't know anyone who served who has had a identifiable problem because they were LGBT. With women, it's been a different story because the whole harassment of women and the rape of women, that if a woman rejected the advancement of one of their commanders, a sexual advancement, the commander would say they were a lesbian and then have them drummed out of the force under the don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
So, of course, for women, it was more difficult.
But I guess I'm wondering about the whole social life thing. You know,
once you move up in the ranks, you need to have a spouse who's going to be supportive.
No. I mean, like just going out for beers on a Friday night. If you can't be, and for many years, of course, you couldn't be mm-hmm. Honest about who you were. You know what I'm saying?
You have to hide
what you are, I guess.
Yeah, when I did 1 in 10 over at FNX, the late FNX, we had straight service members call in often and say they knew that so-and-so was gay and it wasn't an issue and they would talk about it while they were out. Again, I think it's about the level of your colleagues.
Yeah.
You know, back those in the days. But yeah, it's always difficult when you can't be who you are.
Okay, now, Sue, you mistakenly are of the impression that the only reason we have you in is because of your exalted status as the co-publisher of Bay Windows.
But no.
Has nothing to do with it. You have become... unbeknownst to you, our parenting expert.
Excellent.
And so
yes, she has.
It started a couple
boy.
Of weeks ago when you expounded on homeschooling,
yes.
which we got great response to.
Excellent.
And we decided we would broach with you, before we broach it with the listeners in about 6 or 7 or 8 minutes, a topic that Marjorie and I have been discussing on the mm-hmm. air, both as parents and radio talk show types, for a decade and a half, namely, whose job is it to do the homework?
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the parent in the homework of a fairly young child? And so we would like you, as our parenting expert, to start the discussion.
Again, as a
would.
Parenting expert, I'd like to say that my views are my own and every child is different and every household is different. But it is remarkable to me the difference in homework amounts between private schools and public schools mm-hmm. of all grades.
Really? What's the difference?
In private schools, there's barely any homework.
Well, because they often have longer school days and do homework at
they
school.
They learn things in school as opposed to at home at the kitchen table. All right? So I think that pretty much says everything I have to say about homework. But the reality is I think when the kids are little, when they're first grade, second grade, third grade, I think it's important for a parent or somebody to be involved in the homework with the child, basically to help teach them good study habits and to really understand how your kid is learning or not learning.
Yeah, but nobody disputes that. How about the
After
next
that,
step? No, forget that. Stay at that step
there.
And we'll get the
She's getting
No,
there.
Wait a second. You help them with their work habits. You
right.
help them with whatever. They do their work as per your guidance.
Yep.
And you see their grammar is wrong. They're using the wrong words. their math answers are wrong. Do you fix
them? Yeah,
you correct
it. Absolutely, you fix it. Yeah, you do. Because if you don't, and then they go into class, they get a bad grade in second grade. They come home mad at you. The teacher wants to know what you're doing. I mean, I don't know if, you know, you haven't been, my kid's younger. So I know what it's like to sit in front of a teacher and have them say, well, she got this wrong. Like, what were you doing? Why weren't you sitting with her?
Okay, basically? So what happens when the kid's 14?
When they're 14, I think that you really should not be doing the kid's homework. The kid should be doing it. And I do think, however, you should be seeing what your kid has for homework. I think that your whole attention span moves from making sure they get it right and that they get it in on time to seeing what they're being assigned. Because some of the ridiculous busy work that they send kids home with in public schools is atrocious. And I get that, you know, making, and this is, you know, I'm not in high school, my kid's not in high school yet, but, you know, the seventh grade, eighth grade, coloring in the maps, you know, color coding things. I get that for different learners, those things are important. But as a wholesale fix for homework, it's a waste of time. And what you have is the perfect little kids who are neurotic, like my kid, who couldn't make a mistake if her life depended on it. She's going to spend hours making sure that's correct. And then the kid who actually could benefit from that isn't going to. And it's a waste of time.
You know what I think there is just too much homework in general.
It,
I mean,
there is.
If you get out of school at 2 o'clock or 2:30, you have a job or you play sports, you get home at like 6:30, and then you got like 4 hours of homework.
And then you have teachers telling the kids that they don't want to hear about other extracurricular activities taking place with the homework. You know, one of the moments I really thought I was going to completely lose it is when my kids spent 2 days watching movies that were unrelated to the class and coming home with tons of homework. You know,
I'm watching movies in class.
In class, yeah. But we're unrelated to actually.
Yeah, but can I tell you, both are talking. Wait a second.
Movies in class.
I don't know. You know, I mean, or that there's a substitute in, and that's fine. They all
okay.
Everybody gets.
Oh, fine. You're addressing an issue that is not on the table today. We all agree there's too much homework. The issue is this: when they're of a certain age, and you know that what you should be doing, I think most people know, what you should be doing is creating the appropriate environment in which your child does the work by themselves.
Yep.
Do you have the ability and should you exercise the ability to not intrude into the homework thing?
No, the kids' homework in high school should be completely their own that they do. Beside the fact that who can do their kids' homework in high school?
Well, wait a second. You're a writer, Marjorie.
Yes,
Egan.
I am.
When your kid has a writing project and the kid said to you, as I'm sure all 3 years did, or at least I assume at least two or three of them did, said, Mom, could you take a look at this? You take a look at it and you know they screwed up the grammar. You know that the language is – what do you do?
You're wading into the territory that gets me absolutely hysterical.
I know that.
Which is that the public schools, even in Brookline, where my three children went to school, some of the best public schools in the state, do not teach children how to write. They don't teach them grammar. They don't teach them. So that was one thing that I
could do. So what'd you do?
Unfortunately, I would help them because if I didn't show them and teach them grammar – they wouldn't know.
So their work was not their work, essentially. Their work was
their education was not their education.
What it should have been, and I've been on a jihad about that, and I'm getting
with all due
nowhere.
Respect, you're talking about one of the best public school systems in Massachusetts.
I'm in an excellent school system, and you know, it's the homework. The bigger problem is the homework is a one size fits all. And not every parent is going to treat it the same way. And when you have kids who are competing, you know, when you get into the level of they want to get into a good school, they want to be in honors, and they have homework that they can't complete on their own because they haven't been taught correctly.
Exactly.
What do you do? You know, do you just say, okay, well, I know actually how to do that, but you go ahead and pass it in and get a B, even though the teacher isn't available for you know, extra help except on Thursdays from 3 to 2.
Now, here's what you do. Here's what you do.
Figure this out.
Is the other reason I'm on a jihad about this, is if you can't do math, and I can barely add 2 and 2, and my children, you know, they're not idiots. They're not geniuses.
It's a hell of a compliment. I'll tell you, they'd love to hear that, by the way.
What I'm saying is that
your mom said on the radio today, you're not idiots.
They are children
able
to be taught the math, but because once again, and I'm going to get in trouble with anybody at Brookline.
I sat next to the superintendent of the Brookline schools the other day. It's a wonderful school system.
It is a wonderful school system in part, and unfortunately, in public schools, in good school systems and in bad school systems, they're often not taught what they should
be taught.
So wait a
second, excuse me. So essentially, your argument is, so your defense for essentially doing the homework of your child is that I have to do it, says Marjorie Egan.
And I agree.
Because the schools are not doing their job, so I have to do their job for them. Is that your excuse
well,
for
deal,
essentially
Jim,
doing the work of your kid?
When they're 16 and they still can't write a sentence, either you're going to intervene or they're not going to know how
about
to write a sentence.
When they bring home math and you ask the teacher for help and she gives you a YouTube channel for you to watch to teach your child during their homework, how does that – I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, I'd be happy to let
– I can't believe this has evolved into an anti-teacher discussion. This is not about teachers. This is
about
self-control.
No, partly is about teachers.
It's about our education system. It's not about the teachers. I have no doubt that if I had 30 crazy 8th and 9th graders in front of me, all of which are packed into one group – I would be doing the same thing, but it's impossible not to help them with their homework when they don't have the information to complete the homework. Again, if they were in a private school, that's why they don't have homework in private schools, because they're taught
this is
in the class.
This,
you know,
is ridiculous.
This totally didn't go
no
the way
independence.
You thought it
would, did it? No, I knew exactly how it would go, and you're both wrong. Go ahead.
Yeah, excuse me. Oh, I don't believe you for a second. If you let your kid – here's the classic. When they have to make something for show and tell day. Geez. And there
Let's not tell the story about me. But okay, fine. You weren't. Go ahead.
I made the best tortoise once.
Go
got an award.
Okay.
I won the gold prize in the science fair in fifth grade for a camera that I made.
Yeah.
The only problem was I didn't make it. My uncle made it. But
exactly.
We don't. The statute of limitations is run.
So my oldest child, I'll never forget going in. You know, I'm not good in math. I'm not good at arts and crafts. I'm just not very good at that. So I don't remember what the project was. We had to make something. We had to make a bridge or something. And how do you make a bridge? Oh, my God. What am I going to do? I was like a basket case.
So would you hire somebody?
No. So she made this. We got some Play-Doh, and she made some little pathetic bridge. So then I get in there.
Send this tape to our children, will you, please?
I'm looking. You know, my children have all done very well. They've all done very well, despite their not being able to make bridges and do math. Anyway. I get in there for the show and tell, and the parents are all there, and we've got our little pathetic bridge. And next to me
I know.
Is the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge made
an exact replica,
proportions
right.
with little teeny tiny cars and little teeny tiny people, like it's done by an architectural firm in downtown Boston. In fact,
it was done
by an architectural firm in downtown Boston. So it's really outrageous, and they don't prohibit that from going on. I'm sure they didn't prohibit it.
Your point is you have to cross the line. It's sort of like why people do steroids in pro sports. I have to do it to stay up with the other roid rage people.
Let's make a really good analogy here, Jim. It's sort of like you're depending on this restaurant to feed your children, and they're coming home hungry.
Beautiful. On that note, Sue O'Connell.
That's right. You're right. And you know why he has this opinion?
Why?
Because he's Jim Browdy.
He's gotten the President's Award 7 times from
not
the Massachusetts
times, one time
Teachers
from
Association.
The Massachusetts Association.
So he's going to defend them to the death.
It's
no
not about
what.
The teachers. It's about it's about the the
Goodbye.
Way we educate.
Goodbye. Sue O'Connell. Pleasure talking to you, Sue O'Connell.
Sue,
we love you.
I'm losing my ally here. I'm losing you. Okay, we're going to talk about this with you guys. Who do you think is right here? Is Sue O'Connell right? Am I right? Is Jim O'Browdy? Oops. Is Jim Browdy right? First, we're going to say goodbye to Sue. She's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and South Bend News, and she joins us every Wednesday. Thank you for being here. Our number is 877-301-8970. When it comes to homework, are you doing your kid's homework too, or do you let your kid just tough it out? We're going to ask you up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie Egan. I am Jim O'Browdy. Now, if you're just tuning in, we were talking to Sue O'Connell.
Jim.
About what?
I'm having a tough day.
I know. It's okay. It's fine. About homework. Do you help your kids with, and by the way, we're not talking about little tiny kids. Forget that part of the discussion. You know, when they're old enough to be able to get their act together on their own, 11, 12, 15, whatever, or not. Do you give in doing it for your kid because it just makes life easier? Do you do it to see if you can? Are you the kind of parent who has the stuff to let your kid do it on his or her own? And by the way, if you're a teacher, can you tell, and I know you can, when a parent has had a heavy hand in the homework? Our number is 877-301-8970. And let me just, in the spirit of full disclosure here, say that even though I am making the case powerfully that you should stay out of it, you give them direction, you urge them on, you tell them they have to have good work habits, etc., that is not born of an abstract philosophy. I know this is going to sound hyperbolic. The worst fights I've ever had with my younger daughter, who is now 20, in our lives together without a close second were over her homework, where she has made the mistake of saying, Dad, can you help me with this? I made the mistake of saying, yes, I can. And then she rejected my recommendations. And I have to, it is warfare of epic proportions, which further underlined my original position, which is it's their homework. They've got to rise or fall on their own. As tough as it is, particularly when you know they're going to make mistakes you could help them with, essentially you got to let them just do it.
Well, you know what I always think is funny, and I'm sure this happened probably with your kid as well. They reject everything you say, all your suggestions, and you have a big, massive fight about it. And then the next day they sneak their suggestions in because they know that you are right. They just don't want you to let it get away with that. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I mean, the basic premise is homework is supposed to be the kid's job, not the parent's job.
Not supposed to be. It is the kid's job.
But it has become the parent's job in many school systems. And that's why it's so upsetting if you have parents that don't have the time or the wherewithal to help the kids. Those poor kids are getting the shaft a lot of times. If mom is working two jobs, dad's not there, if you're in a tough environmental situation, that's why it breaks your heart when these kids don't get the help they need in school to do the homework. Well, you know where you get that kind of help, Jim?
Yeah, I know.
In charter schools.
877-301. Well, 8970. Charlie Baker is the governor, and he wants – what does he want to add? 50 charter schools. So we'll see what happens. Let's – by the way, if we can, Marjorie is sort of perverting this discussion. And what she has done, and Sue O'Connell did the same thing, is to defend their position that you should do the homework for the kid, which is essentially their position, or thereabouts. They say, well, it's because the kid's not learning right in school. Let's assume for purposes of this that they are getting a decent education. I want to know, in that context, is it appropriate for the parent, essentially, to do the homework? I don't mean all of it, but essentially to augment in a serious and irresponsible way.
All right.
The homework.
Should the parent build the Golden Gate Bridge made out of little popsicle
sticks? Is that a true story?
It is a true story.
That is horrible.
It was humiliating for all involved, let me tell you. Okay, Diane from Swampscott, let's start with you. Thank you for calling. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Diane.
Two words, never again.
Tell us what you mean, Diane.
I have a fifth grader, Swampscott, lovely school system,
yep.
Charlie Baker from here.
Yes.
She writes her rough draft little paragraph, and the teacher assigns them to take it home to polish it up. My husband and I get a hold of it. He adds vocabulary words. I take it from third person to first person. He and I are, you know, on the computer, like, polishing it up. We get the note back from the teacher that says, I liked your rough draft better.
Oh,
never
great.
Again.
That
never
is great.
Oh, my goodness. Not because she knew you did it, but because she thought your kid did a better job than mom and dad?
Yes.
Oh!
That's fabulous. By the way, you know, Diane, you and your husband have created the perfect euphemism for what you did. Do you notice what she said? Polishing it up, otherwise known as doing it. Diane, that was a great story. Thank you for sharing it with us. You know, beyond the fact that it leads, what was Charlie Baker's line from election night? I knew one of us was going to be an unhappy ending for one of us. It's going to be an unhappy ending for your kid. It just is. They got, and by the way,
how many parents do you think are writing their kids' essays?
I don't mean writing,
to college?
I don't mean writing. Oh, huge numbers.
Huge numbers.
And that,
or they go
you don't
out
think
and
that's
hire
a problem?
People. I think it's outrageous. But I mean,
I don't mean just as a moral
I
issue, thought by
the
way.
That was bad enough. But before I realized that everybody else was going out and hiring people for like $500 or whatever they pay them to go out and have their kid write their essay.
Well, that's a whole
them.
Equity thing. The reality is so many kids who live in wealthier suburbs have the tutoring, have the help. It's unfair. And so that's the argument in defense of helping your kid. But the bottom line is they're not going to learn how to do it. They're not going to learn good work habits. They're not going to learn how to – you're not going to go to work with them. Are you going to go to work with them? We've had that discussion too, where parents call employers who are treating their child who's 24 years old. They got to learn to sink or swim on their own. That's the bottom line.
Oh, we got a teacher on the line.
Oh,
I'm about to get read the Riot Act.
We
Mark from Watertown. Thank you for calling, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listen, I think that if homework is meaningful, that kids and parents can do it together. They can all learn from it.
What does do it together mean, though, Mark? What does that mean, do it together?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know SciComm's book, you know, about Khan Academy?
Yes.
That's a great example he has a chapter about homework, and he says homework is totally upside down, that kids should work on meaningful homework at night. When I read that chapter, I went and I went to SciComm's website, and I started with the calculus problem that I couldn't solve in high school, and then I solved that problem, and then I today I could go on with calculus. Mm-hmm. I quit calculus after that, and he has people doing meaningful work at night, and then they come to school during the day, and the teacher's role has changed. The teacher then is someone who finds where kids are stuck, and he has an exact definition of how someone is stuck.
Understood.
Yeah.
During the day.
Mark, you know what? That's a great idea. Those online learning things. Thank you for the call. Those do make a huge difference. I think they would make a huge difference for me because I'm not very good in math to figure out how to, you know, to do some of these problems.
Right, but Mark's also talking about changing the quality and of the teaching and the quality of the homework assignment, that sort of thing. All those things are important. But, you know, Tracy tweeted us this, and I agree. If they pass in homework that you did, the teacher never finds out what the kid doesn't know, which is, I mean, she said, or Tracy, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, Tracy said exactly what I was trying to say, but said it better. Mark, thanks for the call. Let's go to Newton, where Phoebe is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Phoebe.
Hi. So I have a comment that is similar to your previous caller about math, but my example is about writing.
Sure.
So full disclosure, my kids are not old enough to get homework yet. Mm-hmm. I have two preschoolers. And another disclosure is I have an editor mother and an English professor father.
Oh,
but
gosh.
When I was growing up, my sister and I learned how to write from our parents. And both of us are teachers. My sister and I are teachers in one way or another ourselves now. And what we used to do is we would write, and I'm talking about high school, you know, our more complex essays and stuff. We would write them ourselves entirely, and our parents would help us tweak it. And again, there's a big difference between somebody just like flashing it out and substituting their own language.
I totally agree.
The teaching process, which is very, very different. And to say, oh, you shouldn't do your kids' homework is really blurring those boundaries. And, you know, unfortunately, not all children have it. But if parents have a skill like writing, if they can impart that skill without just doing their kids' homework, then I think that's can be very important.
You said it perfectly. And I think the example you described, Fee, with you and your sister, your parents didn't cross the line. They helped you. And that level of helping, I think, is terrific if the parent has the skills. But that's as far as I go. Phoebe, excellent call. Thank you.
Okay. Here's an email from an honest mom, Dana. She says her kids are grown now, but when they were in the Sharon Public Schools, she made an agreement with them. If they had an assignment that required any illustrations done by hand, and there were many, I, Dana the mom, would do all the drawing and coloring. Neither kid was an artist. They didn't even like coloring books. Drawing pictures for homework made them crazy, and I thought it was stupid. Why should a kid's social studies or English grade depend on his or her ability to draw a horse?
But it's not for her to decide on an individual basis. Then go talk to the teacher. Go talk to the principal. Talk to your school committee. You can't individually decide. Oh, by the way, you know what my problem is with my kid in science mm-hmm. class? They're teaching evolution. I don't like evolution. So as a result, we're going to skip
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's different. I mean, again, you were in Cambridge. I was in Brookline. These are both good school systems.
Yeah.
You would see, as I said, all through – Sue O'Connell was talking about these maps that kids would make. Actually,
yeah.
I like the map projects because you get to know where different countries of the world were. It's great, great teacher. Mr. Kelly at the kids' school where my kids went had them do maps beginning with the United States. By the end of their time in eighth grade, they'd done a map of the entire world. It was wonderful. But you would see girls, particularly because girls tend to be more into the details like that, mm-hmm. they'd have these maps that were absolutely perfect, as Sue said, and gorgeous, and the boys would be all over the place. And you would see, in some cases, a lot of suspiciously fantastic maps, and they were helped by the parents.
But is that an excuse for you crossing the line with your kid?
But
I know it's tough to resist.
Parents are really competitive, and they want their kids to go to Harvard, and everybody's going to go to Harvard. And so they help them starting out at an early age in hopes that they're going to get them into Harvard.
And are they doing it for their kid or are they doing it for themselves?
They're probably doing it for both.
Well, I would say more for them than for the kid. And by the way, let me acknowledge here, I know how hard it is. And again, I've lived through the pain of trying to help, mm-hmm. and it is the most torture. I'm not kidding. You've had, I assume, that same experience, right? the fighting is of epic proportions, like gladiators.
It is just unbelievable. Okay, fine. See you later.
Well, that is now it ended with me. And ended with a series of words we're not allowed to use on radio, screamed in both directions, I should say.
Kathy from Middleborough, what do you think about helping your kids with the homework, Kathy?
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a story. English was my second language. And I have a daughter who's 33 years old, and she's a teacher in the school system.
Yep.
She teaches history and math. And she teaches science and math in middle school, junior high. And I keep correcting her English because she never had English. And she had no idea what a suffragette was. I had to tell her what a suffragette was.
And she's teaching history? Oh, my goodness.
She didn't have any history teaching in the teacher's college, and she had no English because they said, unless you're going to be an English teacher, you don't need the English classes. Unless you're going to be a history teacher, you don't need the history classes.
Okay, Marjorie, take it away.
Well, I mean, I'm obsessed with the subject. They don't teach grammar. I remember going in and saying to the teacher, when are you going to teach grammar? Well, and I never forget her said this to me, they'll learn it through osmosis from reading.
Is that what the teacher said?
That's what she told me. And this teacher was sent home notes in incorrect English. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. And I never got an answer. I mean, I asked the superintendent of schools, never got an answer from him.
I was really
either.
Impressed by him, by the way.
But you know what? Because you learned English as a second language, Kathy, you probably know it better. I mean, I sound like I'm...
Oh, that's it. My husband keeps rolling his eyes all the time because if he uses the wrong tense or something, I just look at him and he goes, okay, I know, but you can't help it. It becomes an obsession because it really... sounds so wrong.
Kathy, I think you're channeling Marjorie Egan. Kathy, thank you much for your call.
After, you know, you get tired of arguing about these grammar things, that's why I had Latin. Then you learn grammar. That's the only way you're going to learn
anymore. I understand
anymore.
That, but they're not teaching Latin
in most
public schools.
Well, they are still
teaching
it. Actually, they are. My son took 4 years of Latin.
He did not.
Yes, he did.
He did?
Yes, he did.
By choice?
No, I said, why don't you take Latin? It's very useful.
That's actually spectacular.
Yeah, he did.
Did he enjoy it at all?
Well, you know, like the wars. It's very violent. Everybody's always, invading Gaul.
Remember what Dan Quayle said about taking Latin?
What did he say?
They speak it in Latin America, don't they? That's a true story for those who did not follow the vice president in the late 80s and early 90s.
John in Cambridge, thank you for calling. Jim's hometown, Cambridge. Hi,
John.
Hi. I wanted to pick up on the call that made before by the teacher who started to explain the Khan Academy situation, but he didn't quite get the real point across.
Go ahead.
The whole idea about the Khan Academy is that they reverse the schoolwork and the homework. They have the student reading the material at night as homework and working on the problems during the day where they get teacherly assistance. It makes so much sense. It brings tears to my eyes.
Well, that's, John, by the way, John, that's what Sue O'Connell, if you're listening before, was describing her perspective on the distinction in most cases, many cases, between private schools, which I think you're now supposed to call independent schools for some reason, and public schools. And she says they get it right. And by the way, John, thanks for the call. Both Marjorie and I don't want to speak for you and I'm tired, but you do support longer school days, right?
I do.
Okay.
I mean, we
both support longer school days. One of the reasons for longer school days, one of the many good reasons, is kids can do their homework in school with a teacher there
who
knows how to work with them, as opposed to most parents who have no clue how to work with their kid on this school.
You know, I remember going out for the charter school drawing in Boston, and it was really sad because nobody showed up. And
I read your column on that a couple of weeks ago. It was unbelievable.
It's because this one particular mother had tried a dozen times to get her kids, a single mom, three kids, you know, working all these jobs and stuff, and wanted to get her kids into charter school. Schools and failed and failed and failed year after year after year. But the point is, I remember going in there at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the place was packed. The place was packed until 6 o'clock at night. And what the kids were doing was getting help with their homework. And it's something that is really breaks my heart, actually, that a lot of kids aren't able to get that opportunity, and they're not going to be able to get it at home because their parents are out working. So
how
do you get
ahead?
Also,
when they get home, they should be home. The whole notion of finishing your school, in my estimation, not an education expert. Finishing your school day and your homework is part of the school day, so you have some freedom to live a non-school life, hopefully you're reading a book occasionally, that sort of thing, is huge. I mean, it's so obvious to me.
In other countries, it's so much different. I remember one of my kids, when she got a chance to go over to France in a high school exchange program, they were in school all day there. And then they came home and they were done their homework. So they would have three-hour dinners playing board games because they didn't have to do their homework.
Hey, Jane from Hudson, we only have 45 seconds. Our apologies in advance, but thanks for calling Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jane.
Oh, no, I have so much to say.
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry.
But say what you can.
Yeah, well, for one thing, I think that I was very horrified. I'm a retired teacher, just retired. I was horrified at how teachers were being maligned. But to get to a bigger point, okay, that we haven't talked about self-advocacy. Kids need to take more responsibility for their learning. They shouldn't leave school if they don't understand what their homework is. And we've, like, skipped over that whole
topic. I'm so glad you said
that. That's a life lesson.
Huge. And, by the way, I've had that conversation with both of my daughters about – it takes courage, by the way. I assume as a former teacher you know this, for your kid to stand up and say, essentially, you haven't done your job yet to the teacher because I don't get it. It requires a certain level of something that – but I agree with you. It hugely matters. Jane, sorry we got to let you go, but thank you for the call.
Well, there are great teachers and there are not so great teachers.
Fine,
I mean, that's
Marjorie,
the bottom line.
I know. But Jane is totally right. She was upset when you maligned the teacher. So was I.
Okay. That's why I said there are great ones and there are not so great ones.
I repeat. I'm with Jane. You said it plenty of times.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public
Radio.
Thank
you.
Tomorrow, we have Governor Deval Patrick. He's in with us for Ask the Governor. You can call us up at 877-301-8970 or email questions to us as well. Our team, Chelsea Murr, Will Rose, of Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim O'Browdy. That's what she called me.
Thank you for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow.